Okay. My great concern...
Now you have to say everything again, and we have to fill out the same comments.
Just the same laugh track, please. But what I do need to do is get the... Make sure it still works. Yes. My great concern is that, you know, when you get too radical, you just cut, not only cut everything down to the root, but you cut yourself off from everything else. And that is my concern. And in fact, what I am proposing, as you will see, definitely goes in that direction. The question is, you know, whether I stop short so that there are possibilities left for communicating with the rest of the world, or just disappear. And that's one of the things I'd like to get some feedback from you on. It's a very important question for me. It has a lot to do with, you know, why I thought it would be helpful to have conferences like this. Mm-hmm. And let me say at the very outset that I'm really pleased with the way this conference has been going, and I've really been enjoying it. I appreciate everyone's participation, so thank you. Okay. So I'm going to start with a quote from Daniel Dennett. I think I quoted him twice in this presentation. Can the standard methods, and of course he means the standard scientific methods, be extended in such a way as to do justice to the phenomena of human consciousness, or do we have to find some quite radical or revolutionary alternative science? Now, for Dennett, that's a rhetorical question. He's saying, of course, we have to use the standard method, but I choose the other side of that choice and say, yes, we need to find some quite radical or revolutionary alternative science. That is what a first-person science is going to be, and that's what I intend to explore.
Where's that quote come from?
I believe it's from Sweet Dreams. I didn't get a chance to look it up, but I think the year 2003 suggests to me that it's from Sweet Dreams.
There was a whole issue to go to Dan Dennett's.
Oh, it might have been in the PCS?
Yeah,
Phenomenology
and Cognitive Sciences.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Right, it might be from there too.
Yeah, sorry, it was in JCS and then it was lifted into 2003. It's on hetero, yeah.
Right, on heterophenomenology.
Sweet Dreams, it's who's on first or something
right.
like that.
Okay, next I give you a quote which expresses the fear that I expressed earlier, so I don't have to repeat myself. This is adapted from Charles Taylor, who was actually writing about hermeneutics in social science, but it fit very well. It may not weaken the case of the opposition to bring out fully what is involved in a first-person science as far as convincing waverers is concerned, but a gain in clarity is surely worth a thinning of the ranks. A thinning of the ranks means... You lose your friends. People who thought that they were your friends, it's when you're in an army and the people around you are shot left and right. The ranks are thinned.
It's amazing
Taylor was talking about first-person science.
He wasn't. I said it was adapted.
Yes. Oh, I see.
He was talking about hermeneutics.
Oh, I see.
The notion of thinning comes from the Romanized decimation.
Yeah, basically like decimation. I mean, it's another word for decimation. I think. You're just asking me to give an opinion about something I don't know much about. That's all right. Now that I'm standing up here.
I know. It has an unusual effect on you, doesn't it?
Yes. So this is my concern, in a sense. I think we do need to be clear. I think we do need to get to the root, which is, of course, the root meaning of the word radical. If in the course of doing that we lose some people along the way, you say, well, that makes no sense at all. Well, maybe that's all right. Or maybe in the end you go too far. You know, you have to be able to fight the battle even though the ranks are thinned. So, again, that's the concern that I have and the way that I see it. And I'll probably come back to that image later on. And then I have a quote which is meant to be more hopeful. This is from a little book that didn't actually make much of a stir called Sisyphus's Boulder by Dietrich and Hardcastle. That's Valerie Hardcastle, who's now the editor of Journal of Consciousness Studies. and is a materialist through and through. So I enjoyed the book and don't remember it too well at the moment. But anyway, here's the quote. Ultimately, we will have to be liberal about what we count as a science of consciousness. When science confronts consciousness, it is science that changes.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I like that very much, and it demonstrates perhaps a certain openness on the part of the people with whom we would like to enter into dialogue. This is an issue that Tom raised in his talk yesterday. So let's hope so. Here's an overview of the presentation, what I'm going to be doing. We're going to be starting with our shared starting point. And then I'm going to talk about the main point, what seems to me to be the essential point in first-person science. And then I'm going to present what I am calling radical corollaries. This is where we start getting radical. So there are negative corollaries, which say a first-person science is not this. And there are positive corollaries, which say first-person science is this. So that will set the frame and point out the difficulties, I think. Then I will spend some time clarifying the method. And I should say that part of what I intend to do, this is an experiential session. That's why it's a morning session. So we will be doing some practices. We'll be going back to this practice with centering in the heart, with centering our experience in the heart, and I'll introduce one more practice, basically. But we'll have several little practice sessions. Clarifying the method does not mean staying strictly on the conceptual level. As you will see and as you might expect, the conceptual level, as far as I'm concerned, is not the right place to do first-person science. So it would be a pity if I stayed on that level. I like it a lot, and so you'll hear me talking a lot. But I will definitely make room for the experiential side, too. And then we will talk about, in a sense, the major objectives, objections and difficulties, the issue of subjectivity, objectivity. I think what Ron had to say about that was really helpful. I'm incorporating some of his remarks. And I like very much what Max has said, too. And maybe this is my time. I told you, Max, that I would plug your book. Which you did, but I actually have it here. Very nice book. Cover on the pile about. No, I know. But as an editor, you know. Anyway, but it's a very nice book and fulfills its function admirably, it seems to me, of really presenting a lot of the key issues. And the section on first-person phenomenology is good. Sean Gallagher's article is especially good. And Max's article is good. Max talks about objectivity in his article. That's what made me think about that. And then this final question we come to of, well, you know, if you separate yourself out so completely from third-person science, then is it still science, or why bother to call it science? And I want to talk about that. And related to that are issues of validation and intersubjectivity. Building up a body of knowledge, that's a good idea. And I don't think I included that in my slides. And then the issue of communicating with the scientific community, which we've already talked about. So I am being bold and calling us the Lachmalane Community of Inquiry here, those of us who are here. So what is it that we share? Well, here's my formulation. You might have a slightly different one. The goal is to develop first-person methodologies that give greater understanding, we might say new knowledge, of consciousness. That's meant to be very general. But of course, there are a lot of people in the world who wouldn't think that was an interesting thing to do. But I'm assuming that we all do. We also have, I think, a shared foundation. And this has been said over and over again in many ways during this conference, so I feel very confident in saying it. When it comes to consciousness, experience is primary. I think I took that formulation from Kant by way of Susan. So Max has talked about that, Michelle has talked about it, Ron has talked about it.
Susan has talked about it.
We've all talked about it over lunch. Right. That's right. Well, I didn't mention Kant either. Okay. In the revised edition. Thank you. then I had this interesting thought. I thought, I guess I may say this on a later slide, but you know, throughout this conference, but especially yesterday and from time to time, we say, well, you know, so here's the work that Claire and Russ are doing. You know? And whenever people say that, I feel this little pang of being left out, you know, because I feel that I'm actually involved in doing first-person inquiry as well.
Now you know what the pang feels.
Yes.
Like those go to the core.
So I thought, well, there are a number of things, and I can talk about this on the other slide, I remember now. There are a number of reasons why that makes sense. One is that I haven't spoken yet. But there are other more far-reaching reasons why I might not be included in that group, which seemed to me to make sense. But one of the reasons I thought I could deal with was I haven't had a title. Claire has the explicitation technique, and Russ has DES, and I just say, well, what I do, you know, which doesn't, you know, the what I do approach doesn't quite work. So I started looking around, what can I possibly call it? And kind of like with these name tags, when I realized that instead of painting a bullseye, I could use the CCI logo, I thought, well, gee, I could call this approach creative inquiry, the creative inquiry method for first-person investigation.
Although the what I do label makes the first-person approach very explicit.
It's true.
It's true.
What
you do approach.
W-I-D, what I do. The what I do approach, right?
I'll think about that, because I do have a couple of reservations about using creative inquiry, which I will come to. Well, I'll just mention them now. My reservations are, number one, if I do that, and then I say, okay, the Center for Creative Inquiry is hosting a conference on consciousness studies, that certainly is not meant to suggest that everybody has to agree that they're interested in this particular approach, creative inquiry. And that's been clear, I think. But if I use that name, might it possibly suggest that? I don't mean for it to. And another difficulty is that the Center for Creative Inquiry is meant to be doing a number of things in different areas. The one that, you know, I'm happiest with is consciousness studies, but we do things in other completely different fields. So it's not, again, calling it the Center for Creative Inquiry doesn't mean then that we are only interested in this particular approach to the first person study of consciousness. But that's more my little problem, not yours or anybody else's. So I have those reservations. Maybe in the end I wouldn't use it for that reason, but right now I'm going to say the creative inquiry method. Okay. I'm going to talk a little about why people tend not to put me in the same sentence as Russ and Claire when they talk about first person. One is that what I've done, and I think I have been exploring this for a long time, but what I have done does not fit any kind of scientific mold. You know, Claire and Russ do interviews and at least at some level collect data, and I've not done that at all. What I've done is taught workshops and retreats and courses, and even those, and I have to be fair here, are not called, you know, a workshop on first-person methodologies. The ones where I've really developed my thought about this have been in the context of time, space, and knowledge. The series of books that Tartan Tokov has written, which are ultimately the inspiration for my approach, but you know, they're rather... I see very clearly why I make the link, but I'm not sure that anybody else would. And until fairly recently, I haven't been emphasizing the same kinds of elements in those workshops. I'd like to do that more, so you know, it's something in utero almost. So that makes sense, and you know, that's why I wouldn't be included in the same sentence as I said. But I do think it has a lot of potential. Again, I'm going to try to lay that out today and see what people think about it. And then there's this question that is also a question for Claire and Russ. How do you train people? And I think
one of us has his graduate students in this training. I know that in the past you've said it's rather difficult to train people to be good interviewers. and Claire has put a lot of energy into training people. I haven't given that much thought at all. So that's another reason.
I mean, I've given it some thought, but I haven't made any efforts because I don't really have a program. But part of what this presentation is meant to be about is presenting, beginning to specify the structure of creative inquiry. Okay. That raises a question, ultimately, which is a question for everybody. Is that a little small? It is, isn't it? I'm sorry.
That's probably meant to be.
Yeah, well, okay.
Is there an if?
In other words, is there, so, okay, I do creative inquiry. You know, what is that? What is it? Well, maybe there isn't an it in the sense that I'm very Catholic in my approach. I mean, I have certain things that I think are important and valuable to do, and there's a lot of things that I think are not so important or valuable to do, or less important or valuable to do, but I'm willing to accept anything that works. So, for example, I'm going to be mentioning this morning the exercises that Roz led us in. I think those are great. You know, that's a good way of looking at consciousness. And some of the other things that have come up. So I feel very open. So I'm not sure there is an it. And that's a little bit of a problem if you have a product you're trying to market. You know. And then a good example of that is that I've felt completely free to adapt Russ's method, in the sense that I've been doing some workshops and retreats in the last year or two where I've experimented a little with beeping. And I think Claire has also. People seem to be very free in general to experiment. It seems simple. The interviewing technique is difficult, but people kind of feel they can get the idea very quickly, and so they like to see how people respond. And as you say, everybody likes it, so you like to do things that people like. So there you are, doing descriptive experience sampling. I think that's, you know, that's a great method. I don't use it the way Russ would use it, and that, I'm pointing that out. Okay, so these are the hesitations I've already mentioned. And so now I'm going to go to the question of why this is a radical approach, in my view. I think the right way to do that is to focus in on what first-person experience is, and I'm going to say something I think is completely non-controversial. But my point in doing that is that it seems to me that if you want to develop a methodology, the methodology should match what it is that you're trying to method. You know, the sentence required me to say measure, but I don't want to say measure. That would be totally wrong. So, whatever it is that you want to understand better, your method needs to track it kind of one-on-one. You know, there's somebody in the conference this week mentioned a quote with you, Ron, about the best model of the world is the world. Somebody.
I didn't say that.
No,
probably not me.
Well, it's a quote I've come across before.
Well, I agree.
The world's not very portable.
Right. So in some sense, creative inquiry should partake of the nature of consciousness, it seems to me. So that's why I want to say something, as I said, very non-controversial about the nature of first-person experience. But before I do that, just a reminder, Claire had these four dimensions, satellite dimensions, of what experience is not, what first-person, what consciousness, I would say, is not. The context is not consciousness. Judgments are not consciousness, goals are not consciousness, and knowledge in her grid, her chart, is not consciousness. I might say theory instead of knowledge, yes.
I would just make one subtle, but I think important elaboration on the first point. I would say that experience is not the physical context.
Right. I agree with you, actually, that in fact, later I'm going to come back to these and say that by the time you get down to what it is that I'm really looking at, I don't quite agree that these don't apply. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain level at which they do apply. And I will try to make that distinction.
Are you using experience and consciousness interchangeably?
Yeah, right now I am. I might just sit down and write a paper about it. I probably wouldn't. I'll say something about experience in a little bit, actually, as to the limitation of the word experience. Consciousness is actually also has its limitations, but boy, we're totally stuck with it in this field, and I don't know a better word, you know. Just as an aside, I don't really have time for asides, but David Chalmers in Conscious Mind at one point says, oh, consciousness means so many things to so many people. Let's take a completely neutral and bland term that we can all agree on, and let's take the term awareness. Right? And he thinks that's just totally bland and nobody cares about it. In any meditative tradition, that's just a huge word. Yes. I know from my editing work that Rinpoche uses awareness a lot in his, Tarteng Tulku uses awareness a lot in his books. And whenever we try to translate it into another language, I get these terrible emails from people saying, how can I possibly translate this into French or Portuguese or German? There is no such word. And you know, we spend a long time talking about what that word means. So consciousness is not a good word, but there's probably not a better one. Experience, I will talk about. Okay. Nonetheless, this is a good place to start, I think. It's not the things that kind of surround our experience that we tend to talk about when we are getting ready to try to describe or explain or communicate something or understand something about consciousness. It's something deeper, something more at the center, let's say. So from that I draw one descriptive conclusion and several methodological conclusions. That sounds more formal than it is. So this is the descriptive conclusion. This is the uncontroversial statement that I was planning on presenting to you. Experience is what happens in the present, here and now. I will give you another aside at this point. I remember Tarteng Tulku saying one time early on, he said people like to talk about be here now, but nobody understands be, and nobody understands here, and nobody understands now. So when I say this, it's kind of a casual, superficial statement, but it's still, again, helpful to single things out, I think. Experience is what happens in the present, here and now. That is what is, at least that's closely related to what we have talked about quite a bit, and Claire has mainly introduced it. I'm sorry, these are too small. I actually tried to make them a little bigger later, I think, in the presentation. It says pre-reflective experience, right? That's at least related to this. And then underneath it says, it basically says, I don't like the word pre-reflective experience. And the reason I don't like it is because it privileges the reflective. Right? Let me try moving it a little closer and see if that helps.
just read it out.
No, it's okay.
Okay. Okay. My apologies.
Not the right term.
So, yeah, it's not the right term because it privileges the reflective. Right? If something is pre-reflective, then that means it hasn't gotten there yet, and it doesn't get there until it gets to be reflective. And that's not how I understand experience or the, let's say, the subject matter of a first-person science of consciousness. It is what it is in its own right, and really the reflective is, what's the word? It's derivative. First comes conscious experience, and then maybe, for some purposes, you reflect on it. Now, the reason people talk about the pre-reflective seems to me to be that the assumption is very often made that you don't really know anything about the pre-reflective until you bring it up into reflection, until you, you know, lower your pail down into the well of experience and pull out the bucket, and now you have something you can look at. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's the right way or the only way to do it. I'm not at the moment prepared to say what a better word is. I think I thought about unreflective, but that also sounds privative. I noticed in Merleau-Ponty, actually, I was reading a little bit a couple of weeks ago, and the French word is what, irréflectif. He uses the word irréflectif, I-R-R. And I thought that was kind of nice because in English it doesn't mean a darn thing. Irreflective. And I thought that might be good. It's pretty clear what you're getting at. But anyway, it'd be nice to come up with another word sometime. Doesn't have to be now.
If in English it doesn't make a lot of
sense. But people know that, you know, it's responsible and irresponsible. It's a neologism, I guess you'd say. There's responsible and irresponsible.
So there's. And I'm not sure it's pretty clear what you mean.
Well, so maybe it's not a good choice. It's just I'd like to come up with a word. I don't have one yet.
Just to be clear about what you do mean. Mm-hmm. Are you simply talking about an experience prior to any description of that experience for your purposes?
Right. Although again, the word prior is just like the word pre. It's an experience. And then later, there is the possibility for reflecting on that experience.
Well, or even describing the experience.
Anything.
That's
right.
And
in fact, that's a critical move that I want to make, is basically you have the experience and then you want to operate on it.
Yeah, sure.
Typically, the way we operate on it, if we're trying to make sense out of it, is to reflect on it.
For what it's worth, I actually see the other way. I see that pre-reflective privilege is pre-reflective. Because it gives it primacy.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And it doesn't, you know, all the context in which I work, I wouldn't dream of using the word pre-reflective, because exactly for this reason, because I take for granted the fact that experience is primary,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
anything like a description or a reflection
mm-hmm.
has to be secondary by definition.
Okay.
Because the phenomena has to appear before you try mm-hmm. and make any sense mm-hmm. of the phenomena.
Okay. Okay. Well, that we just have to rethink that a little bit.
I haven't figured out exactly what you're trying to say here, but I think I am maybe in the same context. I sometimes use pristine experience.
Pristine experience. I like that.
In the same sense that new phones know as pristine
right.
before you bought them.
Right.
It's nice.
It's nice. Pristine experience. Okay. Given what I said before about the method having to match up with the subject matter that you're investigating, I think it follows that our inquiry, whatever form it takes, also has to take place in the present, and that the knowledge that we gain through the inquiry will also be present knowledge. And that is ultimately the most radical thing, I think, probably, that I have to say. Now, let me just say this in a way that some of you have heard me use before, and you can put it in writing. We learn about consciousness by being conscious differently. It is when your conscious experience is different, that you understand something about consciousness that you did not understand before. And that happens in the present moment. I am now conscious differently, therefore I understand something about consciousness that I did not understand before.
So those are pretty similar. It's the same idea in different words, or pretty close to the same idea. So it's radical, in the sense that we are returning to the root, that is, we're returning to pristine experience. I'll use that word for now, thank you, Russ. And it is radical in the sense that we've kind of floated in and out of or touched on repeatedly in the course of the conference, and this is actually, you used it more or less this way, Ron. It's radical in the sense that the one who's going to gain the knowledge is the one who has the experience. So first-person experience, first-person science of consciousness is going to be done by the person who's conducting the inquiry. And he or she is going to do it by having different conscious experience. It is not, therefore, I'm not ever going to be completely satisfied with a second person approach. For me, and I say this later, but I might as well say it here since it seems to make sense to say it here, for me, the value of an experience of a method like Russ's and Claire's, and I think Claire is, you know, comes closer to what I'm looking for here. But the value is for the person who is reporting the experience, not the person who is doing the interview, not the person who is collecting the data. The person who is collecting the data is not doing first-person experience in that sense. He's not doing first-person inquiry in that sense. He's not doing creative inquiry in that sense.
But it's still deriving value from the interchange.
Yes. Well, that's right. And may, in fact, be doing first-person inquiry. It's kind of a, if you're aware of what you're doing while you're conducting the interview, and if you see that as a method of creative inquiry, then sure. But if you're doing it with the sense that you want to collect data from your subjects, and that they in fact are the subjects being of the experiment, and you are the one who's going to collect knowledge, to me that's not going to work as a first-person method.
I'm not taking issue with what you're saying, but I suppose the thing that might lose a few people in the field or whatever is that if you're doing third-person science, it's not just the bit where you collect the data, that's part of the whole enterprise. It's also the bit where you come together and theorize about the data. So obviously, if you're the interviewer and not having the first-person experience, but you're trying to learn something, you know, about the nature of this and collecting, let's say, the reports of 1,000 meditators or whatever, there is a sense in which you're still engaged in the large project of first-person science, even though at that moment in time, you're doing this not in this personal inquiry way.
You're participating in the project.
Exactly. Yes. It's just a flourish. It's not in any way an objection to it.
Okay.
Actually, one last comment on the term knowledge that you used there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you understand it as propositional knowledge,
then
it's something that can be passed along without doing the first person. So
right.
I don't know whether that's something maybe like understanding or, you know.
That's right. I do understand. I know what you're asking about or pointing out. And that's correct. I tend to use the word knowledge in a really, really open way because of the way that Tartang Tokoos talks about knowledge. But that doesn't...
Not propositional.
It's definitely... It's non-propositional. You know, you could say non-propositional knowledge, I suppose.
That's not the way I understood what you said. Let's say I had an experience and I had an intuition based on the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely buy what I thought you were saying,
mm-hmm.
which was that... my state of knowing also was in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought you were saying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the knowledge, in state of knowledge, in the state of knowing is itself a conscious state.
Right.
But it could be propositional.
Could be, of course.
Because knowledge, in a sense, you know, it has to do with the second stage, it depends on the kind of knowledge you're talking about.
It depends on the kind of knowledge you're talking about. Let's leave it there for now, and I think it'll be specified more, and I probably have not been really careful with my use of the word knowledge because I take it so much for granted, but I shouldn't. I want to clarify this point. We said it's presence-centered or difference-centered, and I want to clarify what that means. Comparison to Claire and Russ. I hope there's some bullet points under that because I don't know what I'd say right now. Yes, very good.
More print again. Lawyers are good in small print.
I shouldn't read the small print. No, I'll read it for you. I've already made this point, really. Both of their methodologies focus on the past, and we talked about that pretty extensively last night. You were asking people to report on past experience. And while there's certainly value in that, it is not presence-centered and difference-centered in the sense that I have in mind. You ask the question, what happened then? What happened at the moment before the beep? What happened at the moment when you were solving the puzzle? You're always looking retrospectively. Right? And people tend to think that's just a necessary condition. It is if what you're doing is collecting reports. But it's not if you're focused on your experience as the one doing the creative inquiry. Yes.
Excuse me, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
The experience being described is the present experience. Through a special state of evocation, but the experience being described is always present experience.
Well, yeah, that's why I say that you're closer to what I'm interested in than, because I think that in fact that's right. I think that the real value, at least the value that I find, in a past-centered approach like this, is that it evokes a present experience, which can be very powerful. And I'm going to go on to say some things about that. But we've already heard some examples, I think. And you've had some examples, because you've had a chance to do this. You know, whether you would use the word powerful, I don't know, but certainly people have said this was very interesting and very engaging, and I really learned something. Okay, we're headed in the right direction. Okay. This just goes on to the same point. This says these methods are descriptive. Right? And I use that word actually because we were having a discussion during a break last night, Claire and Russ and I guess. And Claire said, well, that's the decision we've made, that we are going to use a descriptive method. I'm not sure you have your words exactly right, but you said that's what we're doing as scientists, right? Or in order to be able to communicate with the scientific community. We've made that decision. That might not be the only way to do it, but that's what we're doing. So I've really taken on your cadences, Russ. It's interesting. Anyway.
That happens to me too, actually. Yeah.
Okay. But there is the possibility, and this is what Claire, I think, was just pointing to, that in doing that kind of inquiry, descriptive experience sampling or explicitation, you are, in fact, invoking a different way of being conscious. You are having a different conscious experience. And that, I think, is really, really valuable. It's one of the reasons I've been experimenting with DES, which, you know, until this session I've understood better, or probably still understand better, because I think it really helps people. Has helped me. But the point then that I would make is that the moment where knowledge arises, or an understanding of consciousness arises, if you want to say it that way, is in the moment of the interview.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to speak for Claire here. But what I hear Claire saying is mm-hmm. kind of the flip side of what you just said. I think what she's saying, and certainly what I would say, mm-hmm. is the past is shining through the present. It's not just the present is shining through mm-hmm. the past. So mm-hmm. I would say the past inevitably is shining through the present.
Yes, actually, I agree. But also, the interview draws the attention of the interviewee to use three reflective dimensions in mm-hmm. his experience. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, in his life, in his everyday life, mm-hmm. The attention, this work continues in real time.
Right.
It's not only during the interview.
But yeah, you're right. But this is the moment where the opportunity arises. So I agree with you, and that's why I say, you know, I am very much in sympathy with your approach. I think in Russ's case, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we've talked about this off and on for a few years now, that's just kind of, I don't want to say incidental, and you gave the example last night of Fran, which I thought was a very interesting example. Someone whose life, well, if we have time, maybe I'll talk about that later. But anyway, that's less the focus for you than it is for Claire, is that present moment of knowledge that may arise. My impression is that you're more interested in gathering the data. Is that fair to say?
I'm not directly interested in changing people's experience.
Right.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. And let me just say, by the way, that because I always feel this needs to be said, when I talk about changing people's experience, I don't necessarily mean in a transformative sense. I mean, in what I would consider a rather limited sense, changing their understanding of consciousness, deepening their understanding of consciousness. That's basically.
Does your changing your understanding of consciousness change your experience?
Probably does. Yeah. Right. I mean, maybe in fact, inevitably, invariably does. But that is at least the road in that I would take. But Susan had her hand up. So
I only wanted to say something to Claude, and I hope Claire will be accepting that it's a simple clarification, I think, of what Christian was saying. And rather than the previous or past experience shining through, I would say it's illuminated through the present. Mm-hmm. Because illuminated also isn't just, it's revealing. So it's brought forth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
For me, the goal is not to change anything, yeah. Just to become conscious of what is there, of the experience, yeah. Which is there, but under the level of consciousness.
Yeah, I don't think you and I disagree about that. In other words, I'm not setting out to change the person. In fact, that's a good way to put it. I'm setting out to investigate, to understand consciousness more thoroughly.
I wonder whether you can do that without changing the person.
Yeah, that was another question. Probably not.
Well, Ross.
And in fact,
Ross says he changes people. I mean, he has a therapeutic effect on.
It can definitely.
But not intentionally.
It just happens through the conscious.
Right.
Whereas Jack thinks it always will happen if you're successful in better understanding consciousness. Whereas I guess Russ and maybe myself,
I think
that it doesn't necessarily mean that you've changed who you are or your consciousness just because you come up with a better understanding of your consciousness.
I think that we don't have to be precise about that right now. I think so. Let's just leave that. And these are some examples from my own experience. One I already talked about in the conference last year, so I'll try to be really quick. It's just that a couple of times when I've been interviewed, once with the one I talked about last year was in a sampling session with Russ, and one came up a couple of days ago in Claire's presentation, actually very similar kinds of experiences. In the course of being interviewed, I realized something that I just didn't know before. This is something similar in both cases. I won't try to go into a big description, but the basic idea was that there's a lot more going on in my experience, especially on the affective level, outside of my body. In the sense that, you know, the kind of question that Russ would ask or somebody asked me the other day about, well, when you have that feeling, where is it located? And when I actually look, it's located outside of my body, in front of me. And the other night, when we were doing one of these sessions, and I had had a thought, I had a feeling, which I noticed was outside of me, and then I had a thought, and it was a thought about Russ. And when they asked me, well, where is that thought located? Maybe they didn't even ask me at that point. I thought, no, it's located over where Russ is located, which was a big surprise for me. That's 30 feet away. But that's what it seems like. I thought that was very interesting.
Before you leave that completely, just extricate that a little bit, you know, because given that, you know, thoughts, for example, was classically the example used by Descartes as having no location or extension.
Right.
What does it mean to say that the thought is located, you know, over where, say, Ron is? Just for you. I don't even quite know what it means.
Right. I don't think I can do a good job of... I don't know that I can say anything else about that right now. I'm going to say, I found that very surprising.
I think it involves your project.
Well, I was wondering if there was an actual... Obviously, a hallucination could be. You could actually see Ron as green, you know, which he isn't, to my knowledge.
Right.
and that would be clearly a green Ron sitting seemingly superimposed on the real Ron, you know. But with a thought, you know, I'm just trying to get a sense.
Right.
What you're saying, really?
The experience of thoughts is very frequently located, not always, but sometimes. And sometimes it's located outside the body, and sometimes it's in the head, and sometimes.
Yeah,
it's
I still want to know what. You know, what that might mean to someone who says that is the case.
Yeah.
Given a verbal thought in psychological terms is phonemic imagery.
Yes.
Right.
Phonemic imagery. You know, when we think something to ourselves that there's the form.
Well, I'd be happy to have that conversation.
Yeah, and I would too. I think it'd be a great conversation.
Yeah,
but
I you might be able to say
I really can't. What I could say, though, is, and Russ, of course, has written and talked about this a lot, is that I think a lot of my thoughts, most of my thoughts are not verbal. Maybe that helps.
But it doesn't matter as far as location.
Okay, fair enough. So I've already said this. So knowledge, the moment for knowledge is the moment of inquiry. And what you said about the past, I think, is completely consistent with that, but I won't try to say any more about it. So this will be here's a moment to introduce an opportunity to see about that, because we've been working with a practice that is a very simple practice that is meant to let you look into this question. The moment for knowledge, the moment for an understanding of consciousness in some sense, is the moment of inquiry. So the inquiry that I have asked you to do at various times and the people have been nicely wearing these name tags with, is centering your experience in the heart or the chest. If you want to think of it as the heart, that's fine. If you want to think of it as the chest, that's fine. And I would like you to take a few minutes now to do that. So sit comfortably. And I think on the second day, I introduced the idea on the first day, it was more focusing on the feeling in the chest. And then on the second day, I introduced the idea that the chest is the center of your experience. That is, you experience the world from that center. But your experience includes the world that you're in. That you're from that center. Rather than what we have been assuming most of the time or often is centered more in the head. And we had Michel's experiment, which tended to confirm that. So we'll just take a few minutes, and then I'll ask for a few comments on that. So you can look with your eyes open, if you like. You can focus, you can center in. You can do it any way you like. Stay with that experience, but open your eyes if they were closed, and just take another 30 seconds to look around the room at the people in the room, set with your experience centered in the chest. Now we go into the interview phase, the descriptive phase, and we could talk about why that seems valuable if it does. Would anybody like to say anything about that experience? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of repeat the point I made after Rose's last night, because I think so many people didn't understand actually what I was saying at the time. So. What I noticed was that when we went out into the snapshot things, we were implicitly actually asked to put our perspective back into our heads, or at least I think a lot of us did. But that was an exercise which was kind of the opposite of what you were asking us to do. And at least for me, what happened afterwards, the debate was a lot more academic, had a lot more edge to it than the usual friendly debates that we have. And I was wondering whether it was something to do with the point of view that we were using actually change the mood of our interactions in the room. Mm-hmm. So, you know, bringing it back through the chest again, you can definitely feel there's a different tonality to the kind of interpersonal relationships than if you're using the visual mode.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Now, I'm going to ask you, because I've been focusing so strongly on the idea of the present, are you thinking back to the experience? Was this evoked by the experience you had just now, or are you taking the occasion to repeat the point you made last night?
It just, emphasized that again. I mean,
mm-hmm. Okay. You had that similar experience that your relationship with people was different when you stayed focused in the chest, is that right?
Right. Well, okay. Just the world in general.
And the world in general, right. Okay.
So, a combination of two things. One, the effect for me was definitely to open up my sense of relatedness to everyone in the room and to feel that kind of a, first of all, a relaxing within myself. I'll say a feeling of love for everyone else here that I've connected with particularly. But also then in relation to what Tom just said, I was one of those people who sat in that exercise with my eyes closed. And when I opened them, the quality of opening my eyes after having done that exercise was very different mm-hmm. from the exercise we did last night.
mm-hmm.
And so I actually got a sense that there is a way to be focused on vision and still be connected with the heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, I want to do something with that later on.
I'm glad you added the bit at the end of having that step around the room, because I found myself just naturally looking at everybody's hysteria and everybody,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought that was interesting. It, in a way, it's a similar point as Tom's, but I didn't feel the way he did about last night, but at least it did show that how your experience can affect how you relate to other people and how you think of the other person. So I was thinking of everybody's located mm-hmm. where I've been trying to locate myself. On the other hand, I think that also gets in the way of, in particular, there's a reason why we look at each other's faces, and because we're more used to interpreting the face as a sign of emotion and connection. So in a way, it made me distant, made me kind of relating to everybody as a body that wasn't necessarily an affective body, but more like just bodies. So it was a kind of strange mixture of relating to people in a different way, but also so alien that it was also hard for me to relate to them in a normal, as people in a rich sense rather than people in a kind of just merely bodily sense.
Okay, just this one more, and then I'm going to make a comment, and then we'll move on. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, for me, it feels useful to make a distinction between the question, where's my experience centered,
mm-hmm.
and where am I centered?
Mm-hmm.
So, Christian, the same strong in terms of, if you like, where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
While, of course, the visual field remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's like changing wording. With
okay.
Yeah.
I'll think about that.
Yeah, it's just, that's just the way it felt for me.
Okay, I want to make a couple of really quick points. One is, in doing that exercise, because I'm up here very much in theoretical mode, I realized something that might be useful to point out, maybe it's related, about the difference between experience and consciousness. The fact that you have a different experience does not necessarily mean that you've understood more about consciousness. I mean, maybe you were feeling kind of unhappy before and now you feel happy or something, or the other way around. I don't know that you've learned very much about consciousness from that, but having a different experience at least opens the possibility of learning something about consciousness, and especially if it's a kind of experience that is unfamiliar. And the more we move into, in a sense, the more we move into unfamiliar realms, the more likely that a shift in experience will in fact teach us something about consciousness. I don't remember my other point of view. Oh, just I was going to say something about the significance of this descriptive experience. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to give you my kind of summary conclusions about this. It probably isn't particularly persuasive right now, but it seems to me that describing experience like this can help you crystallize what happened, but it certainly is not refined in the way that Russ and Claire are refining it, and that would be a valuable thing to do if that's how you wanted to proceed with your creative inquiry. It can go a little bit in that direction, it seems to me. And the other thing that it can do is give you the opportunity to see what it's like, and this again is related to things that Claire does, to see what your experience is while you're describing your experience. That can be very valuable. And one subset of that question, when we're doing this kind of exercise, which is, you know, how we're centering in the chest, okay, so now you start to speak about it. Do you maintain that center in the chest while you're speaking? And what is the effect of doing so? Or if you lose it, what is the effect? So those are all interesting questions, it seems to me, that can come out of this kind of inquiry.
Jack, I don't want to get off the track too far, but I would notice that nobody described the experience of being centered in their chest. They described perhaps the result of the attempt to be mm-hmm. centered in the chest, which is two very different things.
Yeah.
And in the context of the paragraph before we did this exercise where you were talking about location, mm-hmm. We haven't determined at all whether there was an experience of location in the same sense that you said that you experienced your feelings as being out there.
Right. So
we haven't really dealt at all with that issue.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes to the point. I mean, I'm not saying that I would have naturally or automatically or thoughtfully gone to the questions you just raised, but I think they're really good questions. And it goes to the point that these experiences are very rich. There are a lot of ways you can work with them. Even a very simple exercise like this. Okay, let me go on. Okay, so now I want to talk about, having tried to give you a sense or remind you through this last exercise what we're talking about with with creative inquiry, with the immediacy, the presence of creative inquiry, and the focus on different ways of being conscious. What does that mean for doing first-person science? What are the corollaries, the radical corollaries, as I call them, and I divide them up into negative corollaries and positive corollaries, okay? So, the first, and we've pretty much already talked about this, is that we are not, first-person science of consciousness does not depend on reportable knowledge. Right? If you can report it, that's fine. If you know, what you report may be useful and interesting, but it's the experience that counts. And that raises problems down the line. How are you going to share it if you can't report it? You know, I mean, those are things we'll have to talk about toward the end of the talk, really. But fundamentally, it does not depend on reportable knowledge. A first-person science of consciousness, therefore, does not lead to knowledge that can be validated in the usual sense. It's not repeatable. You have an experience now, you may have a similar kind of experience if you do this exercise again. It may be very different. And from my perspective, that's fine. Because you're not really comparing, even within yourself, and certainly among people. Now, again, I think you may find, you know, there are similarities. People tend to report the same kind of thing with this exercise, and that's interesting and useful to know, but the focus is not there.
I think it does lead to knowledge that's repeatable,
mm-hmm.
but it's not knowledge of objective data. In some ways, it's knowledge of a methodology that mm-hmm. can produce objective data.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the data match later on mm-hmm. is, can go either way, but paying attention to the process can give you knowledge about a particular methodology. For
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I think it's a kind of extension of that even in the Eastern traditions.
Yeah.
Whichever one you pick, they all, as far as I know, would claim that a particular path leads you in a particular direction.
Right, and you have and particular experiences.
And they try to describe, you know, what the stages of that are.
Right.
And so that would tend to argue against this. Well, at least there's a global statement. Well, it's true in a sense, what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm, and in fact, it seems to me there are particular, let's say, meditative methodologies, if you can apply that word, that most likely, based on my understanding, would lead to predictable sequences of experience, or predictable experiences in sequence. But I'm not going down that path.
Yeah, sorry, Tim. But can I get you from the other side? So, given these negative corollaries, why is it a science of consciousness?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to wait till the end.
Okay.
Okay, well, you and I can talk about that.
Exactly, the contrary that I tried to explain.
Right.
I also don't agree. I mean, you're basically saying you're throwing out the whole Husserlian project out of the window just because of things.
Yeah, well, you know, I
don't feel that. It's an exploration of consciousness, but not necessarily of science. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to talk about that. But I actually, you know, I distinguish what I'm doing from a Husserlian approach. Not that I never feel qualified to speak about Husserl, but. I don't think you're getting at essences. Let's put it that way.
For me, the Husserlian approach is hardly the usual sense of scientific validation.
Yeah. Okay.
Excuse me.
Husserl's approach is not the typical approach to validating science.
Okay. But that's good for me to know. I mean, to get that reaction, and I'm happy to talk with people about it. Yes.
Is there another sense in which you could validate that, for instance? By just not intersubjectively accepting a certain content, mm-hmm. but for somebody, for instance, to recognize his own experience in the report of an experience of somebody else.
Yeah, I think something like that. In fact, I will get to that at the end of the talk. I want to talk about the issue of intersubjectivity, which in effect is intersubjective validation. But right now, I really meant to focus on intersubjective validation in the sense of data that you can validate.
But Jack, really, can you explain how this type of inquiry is a science of consciousness? There are hundreds of like this from exploring.
Mm-hmm.
They don't claim to be science.
Mm-hmm.
What makes this type of exercise of inquiry,
the science.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I said to Jack when he submitted an abstract to some. Remember?
Right.
Why is this radical science?
Yeah. Right. I think it would throw me too far off if I tried to answer that question right now, but I am definitely going to be looking at it at the end of the talk. So if you can wait.
I've been looking at this issue quite a lot over the years. That's what my next book is about. I would basically just put it out in lots of discussion, just as my perspective at this moment. But what makes it a science is not to do with the nature of the data, but it's to do with the methodology. I just lost my point. Oh, it's a science because it's a rigorous methodology. There's a rigor to the methodology. Yeah. That's right.
I will develop this. Actually. That gives me a clue as to how I would answer the question right now. It was just sort of out of my mind because it's at the end of the talk, because I'm not at the end of the talk. But I think I still would rather wait till the end of the talk. And by then, I will have introduced some of the elements that will help me give my answer. I'm not saying that it's going to satisfy everybody. Okay, and this is just a small corollary. Well, I guess I didn't get to this point. You are not trying to explain consciousness in any way, which means essentially, and Michelle has made this point, I think, exact, more or less the same words, that the hard problem then disappears. In the third person science, doesn't have any good way of getting at experience, and so it's got a hard problem. First person science, you could, if you wanted to, construct, and maybe that's what people are saying in a way, its own hard problem, which is to say, well, how does it get back to the third person data? I don't think that's really a problem for reasons that will become clear in a moment, but the usual hard problem is just not an issue. Okay, there's more. first person science of consciousness does not develop theories about consciousness. Now, I think that there are certainly things to be said about consciousness, and I have my own ideas, and I've actually been debating in the last couple of days, am I willing to call them theories? Maybe. But I don't like the word theory in a first-person context, and in a little while I will show you, try to explain why. There are some distinctions that I like to make, but those distinctions are themselves theoretical. Nonetheless, it seems to me that the moment you start developing theories, you are no longer in the first-person realm. You can do first-person inquiry, and then on the basis of that, you can develop theories. But at that point, you're not doing first-person science, except in the sense that Max mentioned earlier, which is you are participating in the grand project of first-person science. This is pretty much the same point, but just focusing in on a particular area, it doesn't explain. Didn't I already say that? It doesn't explain consciousness, so I'll go on. Okay. It also doesn't have an ontology, and here's one place where I would disagree with Michel. You know, I'm not an idealist, certainly in this, you know, whether I am or not, I don't think I am, but I wouldn't be for first-person purposes, you know, for purposes of creative inquiry. I would, I might be willing to talk about being a mentalist or an experientialist in this, for first-person purposes, in the sense that what I'm interested in is the mental realm. That's, for those of you with a Buddhist background, you know, that's the word that Gunther uses to translate Yogacara.
Just the point that I'm not an idealist either, but that when I see somebody who is not, who is a realist, I think it's better to educate that fact.
Yes. Hit them with the idealist hammer. Okay.
The opposite as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if they make a way, I'm not an idealist.
I'm not interested to have
that. Okay. In any event, no ontological claims. First person. Basically, I'm saying that the first-person perspective does not make claims about the way things are, although I have to qualify that because I use that term in a special way. But it doesn't make claims about what's about reality. It's focusing on experience and on the mental realm. And therefore, and this is getting even more radical, it doesn't aim at discovering what's true. It only aims at discovering the way things seem to be. Again, as long as you're in the first-person mode, as long as that's the kind of inquiry you're doing.
Because I still say that in the problem of consciousness, appearance is reality.
Exactly. Appearance is reality.
They're not the same, because if you go that route, then you are trying to...
Well, in the realm of consciousness, okay. I would say,
which one are you going for? Which one?
Okay, to the extent that Husserl is making, well, when you say in the realm of consciousness, for me, that is taking the ontological claim and putting a big X through it. But I'm not sure. Perhaps that's not what Husserl meant. That's what I would mean. And then I would say, appearance is what we're interested in. Maybe that's a more neutral way of saying it. Okay? Appearance is what we're interested in. And then, one more, given all of the above, first-person inquiry, first-person science of consciousness, and I know I have to kind of put brackets around that because people aren't convinced right now that it is a science, but bear with me. A first-person science of consciousness does not try to meet third-person science on its own turf, its own territory. Right? Which I think is what neurophenomenology does. Now, again, I think that there's a place for neurophenomenological inquiry, but I think that you have to get much more clear about what the nature of the realm that first-person inquiry is investigating is. You have to understand more clearly what it looks like to come from the perspective of appearance and seeming and conscious experience and all of those things. And when you are doing that kind of inquiry, you really are looking at very different kinds of things than third-person sciences. And until you're clear about that, and I think it's very dangerous to try to make alliances, because you wind up giving up your own position. So that's part of what I'm going to be trying to do in the rest of this talk. We'll have to see how we do.
Do you refer to something special? a special try to do that? Or?
Well, you mean something where I'd say we should not be marching hand in glove with neurophenomenology? Is that what you mean?
No, but you said that it's dangerous and so how do you know?
In what way is it dangerous?
Yeah, yes, well, for example,
do you think about an example?
Yeah, mostly what I'm thinking about here is the emphasis that you tend to get in the literature on qualia. That's mostly what I'm thinking of, or a little more broadly, a perceptual situation. I think that at least a perceptual situation is fine, but if you're talking about seeing a red patch, I think you really have thrown out most of what goes on in consciousness. And if you're talking even about seeing a red cup, you are leaving out a great deal of what is interesting and important about consciousness. You know, I've never really tried to think through the kind of work that's being done with meditators, for instance, or for that matter, the work that you've done with epileptics, which is a different matter.
Okay, can I give you an example? Just one sentence example. There are so many. I'm a big fan of neurophenomenology, but there are so many examples how it's absolutely not the equal. These two are not on equal ground. So you have like neuroscientists. And then, like, first personal phenomenological researcher helps him. And then, whenever neuroscientist finds objective stuff about what's going on about with you, neurophenomenology is like totally forgotten. That I have a list of examples where that happened.
Really?
Exactly. And I think that what happened with Varela's map, and you told me about it, is exactly this.
No.
I'm going to ask you.
Totally, I don't
Okay. Yeah, they abandon phenomenology, not neuro.
Okay, so I'm gonna move on. Very interesting. Okay, here are some positive methodological corollaries. And this begins to spell out, I think, what are the problems that I have with or the reasons that I think that conscious inquiry then has a very different field of inquiry. A first-person science of consciousness looks at the whole of conscious experience rather than singling out specific perceptual data or qualia. Descriptive experience sampling or explicitation techniques are both wonderful for helping to point that out, because you realize at least something about what the range of experience is. Right? If you're focused on a red cup, it's a little different from the kinds of samples that Russ tends to get. I mean, the point is maybe not well made there, but my point is really like this. Well, let's say my shirt. Here I am wearing a shirt, right? So you have your opinions of this shirt.
It's very nice, actually. I was admiring
it. Oh, thank you. But I have a whole lot of, I mean, actually, this shirt I don't control much. But I have a lot of background, and this begins to get to the reason why, you know, context, I think, really does come into conscious experience in terms of what the lived significance of things are for us. You know, it's where I bought this shirt. Now, this is not a good example, because I have no idea.
Make something up.
No, I have too much time. I'm worried. This notebook, right? It's just a notebook, right? I spent years looking for the right kind of notebook, because I always carry a notebook in my pocket, and they were always the wrong size. And usually they had those little YROs, they're called, which make them kind of they're actually called YROs, but technical term.
In America.
They hurt your hand to write on, and if they're on the left side, I'm left-handed, and it makes it very awkward, and if they're above, well, that's okay, but that's better. That was a better choice. Anyway, I finally found this notebook, and I've been buying it ever since, the last 10 years maybe, and it makes me very happy every time I open it up. That's telling you something about the range of conscious experience.
But it's all comments and explanations.
It's all context in this case, yeah. But it is not, you know, my description of it is just giving you the context. But the feel of what's going on, when I hold this notebook in my hand or notice it, is my conscious experience. Right? And that's really what I'm trying to point to. And of course, you know, it's just one object. Consciousness really is the range of things. But it might be that I'm focused in so intently on this notebook that really would be most of what I was experiencing, but it would include all of those different elements. And for that matter, it would include the at least 5 or 6 times in my life that I've told people more roughly the same thing about this notebook. So you know, that would be a kind of a shadow stalking my experience of the notebook.
You are very happy with that notebook.
Yeah. Works a lot better than the shirt, doesn't it? Okay. This is really saying more or less the same point. Well, maybe it's a little different point. I'm conscious in a holistic way. I don't usually use the word holistic, but it seems to work here. And if I am conscious differently, that is, if anything about my experience is different, then that will affect my conscious experience as a whole in some degree. Now this is, I'm probably going to say some things that are intrinsically more interesting about this in a few minutes, so maybe I won't say anything about that right now. And I just wanted to make the point, this is probably small to read, but that doesn't mean that you don't focus on particular elements, for instance, my notebook. You know? You don't always have to be trying to get the global thing, the whole, you know, whatever it is, that is the center of your experience, is the center of your experience. But that center radiates out in somewhat the same way that focusing on the chest radiates out into experience, into the whole of your world, your lived world. And the reason, I just mentioned some of the things that you're going to be looking at here, issues of meaning. And this is kind of an issue of meaning. What does this notebook mean to me? Moral stances, you know, what are my values and my concerns? Interpersonal relations and so on. Those things are all part of what is going on in conscious experience. And, you know, it's going to be tough to get into that if you're kind of limiting yourself to what third-person science does. I mean, I know third-person science studies those things in different ways, but I think you see my point. And as I say here, and this is a teaser, first-person science is also, or creative inquiry, let's say, is also going to investigate more fundamental dimensions of experience. We'll get into that in a moment.
I couldn't read the last little bit.
That's what I just said. I said.
Did you read the whole thing?
I didn't read it word for word, but no, I summarized it very accurately.
It's hard to hear this dichotomic listening test.
Okay.
It was the moral senses that I picked up on.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the endogenous intersubjectivity and phronesis. Okay. Like
Let me say, by the way, that in the first conference, when we sent out the invitations to it, Steve and Wendell and I remember we had come to this conclusion and I remember the language, because I thought about it quite a bit since, we said something like, our hunch is that the moral dimension will turn out to be very important for consciousness study. The language I remember is our hunch is, because it really was kind of a hunch. And so I've had occasion to think back on that over the last couple of years, because I feel like it's getting
very strongly in, apart from one or two.
No, it hasn't in our presentation. Yeah, I still think it's right, and I'm more convinced, definitely more convinced now that it's right. But it hasn't figured in our presentations, and it won't figure much in this one either. So that's interesting. Okay.
I concluded on moral and ethical issues.
You did? Yes, thank you. At least it has not gone unmentioned. So how do you actually do this? I've basically laid out what's the fundamental point, which is you focus on present experience. What are the negative and positive radical corollaries? I think you'll agree they're pretty radical, maybe too radical. And maybe I'm no longer doing science and those issues. Now, how do you do it? Okay. So I want to introduce what is probably the single guiding conceptual structure that I use for making sense out of this stuff myself. And some of you have heard me talk about it and I've written about it. It has to do with stories. I call it the story. Maybe it's more accurate, I've been thinking the last couple of days, to say it's a theory. I'd like to call it the story, but
Maybe it's a theory. I don't think it matters too much.
Theory?
No, definitely not the theory.
I think the story is going to mix it up with all sorts of theory.
Yeah, well, actually, I wasn't thinking about that. In fact, I've never even heard of theory when I left that, maybe. But, yeah, maybe it's actually kind of cool. Theory, and story. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, so when we talk about stories...
Actually, Dan Hutto talks about narrative. It's very important in his response to theory, so mm-hmm. you might suggest that to him.
Story? Okay, so I want to reserve the word story, and I've got a pretty specific sense of what I mean by story, but anyway, I'm about to get into that, because it will help me then lay out the rest of it, which we'll get back into some experience, don't worry, but we're, of course, running a little late, as we might expect. So when I talk about stories, there's three things I like to distinguish: lived stories, told stories, and theories. Theories are not stories, but lived stories and told stories are two varieties of stories. And it's a distinction that I'm not aware of people making. It seems to me to be really, really important. The lived story is what we inhabit. It is the world that we inhabit. That's how I would like to say it. And another way to say that is to say it's the way things are. We have a story that we are living. Doesn't mean we put it into words. It's not a told story. And in fact, I think it takes place on a very deep level. I'll give you a bunch of examples in a while. I have no doubt that conscious beings in general, going way down the hierarchy, are living stories. We all have the way things are. I suppose it's related to the what it's like, right? There's always a what it's like, and that means there's always a way things are. You can't draw one from the other, but I would say they're paralleling, right? And I think it's at least interesting to compare that to what you were saying with your robots and expectations. You could say, the way things are is that we always have an expectation that things are going to be a certain way in the next moment. That would be another way of getting at the way things are. If that's helpful.
I'd be very suspicious about that move.
The one I just made?
Yeah, just that.
Okay, well, don't forget about it. I just thought it might be interesting.
Could you just say why it's a story, the way things are?
Because
things are a certain way at the moment. How you expect the future to be is a simulation.
Yeah, you're right.
I would say the whole, the notion to take that for granted is a big mistake. Yeah. Even if there is something to be said for it.
I agree with you. It raises issues that probably don't need to be raised. I just thought it might be interesting for people here because Ron presented his paper. I wouldn't. Yeah, you're right. Why is it a story? Because it's got a very basic kind of a plot, and because it's got a scene and a setting. I've never really tried to spell it out that clearly. I guess, again, because I kind of take it for granted. There is, now this I'm borrowing from Tartan Tulku. This is one place where there really is a clear intersection with the time-space knowledge books, because that's where this idea ultimately comes from. He talks about what he calls the founding story. There's always a founding story. And the founding story is here I am.
Okay, so not all stories have to have beginning, middle, and end.
No. Founding story is what's going on right now, and stories are, and there are layers of stories, and that's probably something I didn't get into much here. But the basic idea is it's a story in roughly the same sense. I think it's helpful to think about it this way: as a novel or a movie, the characters in a novel inhabit that novel. Right? That is their story. The plot unfolds within the context of that story. And so another example that I always think about is in a movie, the opening shots establish the world of that movie. Right? They establish the lived story. Some movies do that more consciously than others, but that's roughly what I'm...
Some movies deliberately don't do it.
Some movies deliberately don't. That's
right. Are the opening shots then the founding story?
No. I think only characters can have founding stories.
So is the best story of me in the same way as the best model of the world is the world?
I think so.
But well, I guess what I have to say is, you know, I don't really want to make that distinction quite that strongly. The story is going to be me in my world. But yeah, in terms of that image that I used earlier, right? Because in other words, there's no model. The moment you get into models, now you're probably talking about myths, the told stories, or maybe theory. Okay, so I'm going to have a number of examples now to try to flesh this out. I think I'll kind of skip this dynamic dimension. Well, maybe it's worth, what I say here is there are dimensions to the story, and one way that you can organize it is in terms of a dynamic dimension, a temporal dimension, if you will, because when I say the way things are, I do really have in mind the are and
the being. Exactly, right. Yes.
Okay. The way things are. There's always a dynamic dimension of what's happening. In the here I am, there's always the am. You know, there's, and the here I am has that. It's got the spatial structure, it's got the temporal structure, and it's got a meaning structure, which is centered on the I. Right? That's a nice, easy way to remember, think about it. So there's a spatial dimension, a dynamic dimension, and roughly speaking, a dimension of meaning. That'll do for now. I'm going to skip column again on space. Then there's the told story.
Leo tells story.
Right, that's the one. the told story, I think in the paper that I did in JCS on this, I called it the narrative. And people said, well, a story is a narrative. I don't get it. I don't understand. And I put a footnote in and I tried to explain the difference. But since then, I've come to the conclusion that it makes more sense to talk in terms of lived story and told story. People get that more easily. The told story is the story that you tell. You may tell it to yourself. Or you may tell it to other people. And inevitably, when you give a description, when you do an interview, it's a told story. That doesn't mean it's not connected to the lived story, but it's a different animal. It's a told story. Let me try to suggest something about the interplay between the two.
Just before we lose it, one thing that's been confusing, well, it's not confusing because I know what you're saying, But now that you've raised the told story and you've described what you mean by it, would you distinguish the story that you tell about what you experience from saying what it's like for you now? So normally, you might be in a situation, this is what I thought you meant when you were talking about the lived story.
Mm-hmm.
So I could say, look, I'm really feeling this problem with you or this is, I want to interact with you in this way, or I'm now experiencing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm telling a story about what I'm experiencing,
right.
But I'm actually telling a story now,
right.
While I'm experiencing, and I'm including the whole flow and dynamic of the experience in the way that you want to do.
Right.
But it seems to me there's still kind of three things that you could maybe want to distinguish in your kind of methodology. Mm-hmm. One is just being there.
Yeah.
And one is describing as you're being there.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is the kind of narrative where you describe how it was for me, maybe soon after it's happened.
Right. Yeah, I think maybe you could, that might be helpful to have these different levels of told story, some of which are more likely, we can hypothesize anyway, to be closer to the lived story. That seems right. I haven't really thought about that, but yeah, that's good. So I wanted to just quickly mention something about the interplay, because there's actually something really important here. When you tell a story, or when someone tells you a story, it's a candidate for becoming a lived story. That's in a way how our world changes, right? That's how our experience changes. We may start to tell ourselves a story about ourselves. So I think you can see children doing that. Or at a certain point in our life, we may start to tell ourselves a story. And that becomes a story.
Man, I think we do that all the time.
Yeah, I think we do too. I think we're actually always, and in fact, I think what's really happening, but I don't want to try to demonstrate it, but I think what typically is happening is the image I always think of is a tire that gets punctured, and it's a self-sealing tire. So, from moment to moment, almost, our story is being punctured. And sometimes it's just almost as, blows up. But, and we just really quickly tell a story to make it fit back together, to seal the puncture. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I do think that, in fact, we are constantly busy telling ourselves a story. But it's important that it is connected to the lived story. It's either helping to keep the lived story intact, that was really the example I just gave, or it's a candidate for reshaping the lived story in some way. It's a solicitation, as I said. And then, of course, you know, the told story has to in some way match up to the lived story. If it doesn't, you've got a problem. And people, you know, and then they go into therapy. It does happen. They don't match up.
Jack, I'm still a little confused about the lived story. So mm-hmm. my concept of story has essentially the possibility of a teller and somebody who could be told the story and a medium in which the story is told. Doesn't mm-hmm. have words, could be pictures or something like that. So how we use this concept to understand experience. So are those parts of my concept of story applicable to the lived story? Is there a teller? Is there somebody that it could be told to, and is there a medium?
I don't think that's the most basic level of the lived story. I think that's already, it may well be that the story that you're living has a teller as well as an experiencer. Right? There's someone who experiences what's going on. I don't know if the lived story really has a teller, because tellers don't come into play until you start telling something. So now you're in the realm you have the capacity to tell a story.
I guess the more you subtract out essential parts of
right.
my intuitive concept of story, the less helpful the metaphor, if, I don't know if it's a metaphor,
it's
but
basically
this
a metaphor, sure.
device
right.
becomes. But
right.
Is that what you want us to do? Like, in a way, subtract out, think of it as a story that you're way into it,
mm-hmm.
and then subtract out the need for a teller, and subtract out the need for
that's
somebody to be told to, subtract out the medium, and then you have left the most basic of the story.
Well, I think that would be an interesting move, and an interesting way to think about how you want to work with the lived story, because basically what I'm going to say is that consciousness studies is going to involve bringing elements of the lived story to light, and doing something with them, to probably call them into question or to vary them. And so, yes, take the most basic elements and see, can you call them into question? That would be good. It's not easy to take the most basic elements. Maybe that's something you want to start.
So are you saying that the lived story has actually some existence, or are you saying that in a manner of speaking, it's worthwhile to conceptualize that we have this lived story?
I'm not quite sure what the distinction is there. It has an existence. I'm saying that that's a good way to think about our experience as conscious beings, is that we are living a story. So if that's real, then the lived story is real. But it's still just a metaphor. I mean, it's not written down somewhere or anything like that.
So the question is, are we really living a story, or does it just make sense in some way of therapy or change or whatever?
To set things up, right. Well, that's why I said it's kind of basically a theory or maybe a story, maybe a told story. I guess I'm feeling more happy saying told story again, because it's a solicitation to view your experience in this way. That doesn't mean it's ultimately real.
So it's a story.
Yeah.
The lived story is in fact a story.
Yeah, but in fact, and what I say about the lived story is a told story. Yeah.
Yes.
And I've already gone into this, I think, in the interview techniques that we've been talking about. You're telling a story, and that's an invitation to live, to develop a different lived story. It doesn't have to happen, and it may not be the point of why you're doing it, but it seems like to me that it's almost invariably is that. And then if you find yourself living a different story and you tell that story, then maybe that leads you to a different lived story. So there's a very close interplay back and forth, which is what I was trying to say before. And then I've also already made the point that when you're looking at this level, things like context really do become part of the lived story and part of our conscious experience in a certain sense. It's not, you know, if you're going to focus on the immediate moment, then context is not something you want to look at. That seems pretty clear to me. Or if it does come into play, it will be, I won't say any more about that. goals in the same way. I think goals are actually a really important part of our lived stories. You know, we're living towards something, if you want to say it that way. And then just a point about intersubjectivity, and this again has to do with the interview technique. If you want to engage the lived story, it helps to be doing it with someone else, because I think that that helps you get to the level of reality that the lived story is insisting on. The lived story is saying this is the way things are. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it's cultural or if it's just, I don't know, but for whatever reason, if we are just trying to, if we're just working with our story, our lived story, the way things are for us, if we're doing it on our own, there is this tendency to turn it into just this little fantasy that we're having. If somebody else is there to validate it, not in the sense of validating, yes, this is the way things are, but just to validate that you're operating on that level, I think that helps. And I think that's one reason that the interview techniques that we've been talking about are powerful. And I would say my own experience with that comes more out of teaching workshops and retreats and so on, and especially in the TSK mode, but this also comes up when I teach Buddhist-related materials. Being together in a group doing a practice like this operates at a deeper level, and that deeper level is related to what I'm calling the lived story. It's easier to work there. Yeah.
Just to give you an opportunity to make this even more radical than you have so far, I'd like to just draw on Susan's video from last night and mm-hmm. say that Amanda Baggs, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
That her interaction with her environment is that story. So the interviewer does not need to be another human being.
Yeah, yeah. No. Well, okay. That's
well,
important.
This is a movie category.
No, I think Christian's making a different point.
I'm not talking about us watching her. I'm talking about her embodied experience of interacting with her environment.
Yeah, and it may be that part of the point that she's making is that right. she is, in fact, in intersubjective
that's what I got from
reality
yes.
with the world,
yes.
whereas we have to have other human beings, or at least dogs and cats.
The reason that it came to us was through the camcorder, but she was relating to the camcorder, that's what I was saying, in a way that another person might relate to it.
Okay, well, I'm going to cut that discussion right there and just point out that that leads to the idea of communities of inquiry, which I will touch on later. Okay, so I'm going to go on with that and just and say something about theories instead. And the main point that I want to make there is actually related to that quote that Roz read last night from Arnheim. Theories are not stories. Theories are deliberately designed not to be stories because they are meant to be basically, I would relate it to the view from nowhere. They're meant to be something that you can abstract from whatever else is going on, and it's just a propositional statement. Okay? It's meant to be a propositional statement about the way things are. But for me, it's important to make the distinction between a told story, which is telling you about the way things are for me, or for, basically for me, and a theory. And I think it's helpful to look at the original meaning. I have this in here somewhere. So they don't offer a link to told stories. They're impersonal. The reason I put Plato's name up there is that I think he's the kind of ideal type of the theoretician, because there he is in the cave and he gets free from all his misapprehensions and he leaves the cave. He goes somewhere else. And that's the theorist's move, it seems to me. He does a lot of interesting things, and there's a lot to be said about Plato, and I'm not dismissing him, but for these purposes, he's the ideal type of the theorist. This fellow...
somewhere else, too, right? When, by giving people different experiences, you're trying to move them, take them somewhere else, too.
No, I'm trying to change the else. I'm trying to change where they are. If I'm trying to change, which is different.
What is moving someone to change where you are?
Well, no, I'm...
I know.
I came out of Plato rather than
Plato. Well, let me put it this way. This is, for me, the interesting move, once this fellow gets released from the rock in the cave, would have been to spend a lot of time investigating who are these people who have been doing this thing to me, right? Who are the people who parade these shadows in front of the fire? But, Plato's guide spends a little bit of time looking at that, but then marches right up into the sun. So that's what I'm pointing to. This guy, Lefkowitz, is somebody I read back when I was in graduate school, but the book probably says the same thing now that it did then. He wrote a book, Theory and Practice, in which he talks about the origin of the word theorist. I've seen this somewhere else too, maybe in government, but he goes into it in some depth. He says that the word theorist was originally applied to visitors from another city-state who came to observe religious observances. They were formal invited guests, dignitaries, who came to observe. They came from somewhere else entirely. That's the idea of a theorist. I think that's helpful. This is the point that Tom made, that we got into a very theoretical mode last night. And so maybe that gives you a sense of what it is. And at one point last night, Claire was, we were talking about time, which if we have time, I'll get into a little bit. We'll do an exercise with it. I don't know if we will have time. She said, well, this is a very interesting discussion, but it's very abstract. And it would be nice if we could ground it in some experience, right? Theories are not grounded in experience. Theories are abstract. And I will be saying something about this abstract quality later. Ron, your move is, I think, really interesting to say, well, the scientist doesn't have to be this guy who's always theorizing, or, you know, in fact, will be a better scientist if he's not always taking this abstract view from nowhere position, always engaged in theorizing, that is, in fact, relying on his own experience. That would take him much more into the lived story of who he is as a scientist, which I think is a good move, and maybe that's a place where you could have some communication. I'm not sure. I'm going to skip that. This is just an example to try to point out the difference. It's a perceptual example, and for that reason it has its limitations. But anyway, this is a kinesic triangle. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. You see the triangle, right, the white triangle there. Everybody sees a triangle as far as I know. And at the same time, you know it's not there. So your theoretical knowledge tells you that it's not there, but you see it. And you can explain that in any way you want. You know, the explanation is going to be on the theoretical level. But, you know, propositionally, theoretically, you know that it's not there. In terms of your lived story, there it is.
I think it's possible not to see it.
Okay, well...
spontaneously, it's true.
Yeah, spontaneously, I'm talking about it.
There is a mode of concentration in which you can avoid seeing it.
I think
seeing the pieces.
I could imagine that would be the case. That would mean...
I can see a triangle with those metal lines, but I can't see any white lines.
But you don't see this triangle here?
I see two triangles.
No, I didn't see two.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. I haven't shown it to that many people, but I just thought automatically everybody saw it.
Yeah, I know this.
Yeah.
And I'm sure really is there. It's just not outlined.
It's been created. You could make that point. Okay, let me move on. But the point about the Kanizsa triangle that I wanted to use it for was this difference between theory and lived story. And even though I used the word kinesthetic because Susan was talking about with somebody else, I'm going to move right ahead. Okay. Here's another example that I've used for years. And this week, during the course of this week, I've realized that I actually didn't understand it. Everybody loves to use this example. The sun, we used to think that the sun moved around the earth, and now we know, of course, that the earth moves around the sun. The way things seem, remember that's what we're looking at, is that the sun, it doesn't seem that the sun moves around the earth. It does seem that the sun moves through the sky. Right? And if you say, oh, the sun is moving through the sky, and somebody says, well, you're not being very precise or accurate in what you're saying, in fact, the earth is rotating around the sun. Well, I would say the way it seems, the lived story, is that the sun is moving through the sky. And the fact that in terms of theory, in terms of reality, in terms of objective reality, if you want to put it that way, the Earth moves around the sun, doesn't matter.
Surely it depends on your point of reference.
If you want to know the truth, it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, it does if you want to.
It's a reality issue.
Excuse me?
It's all, I mean, the whole business,
you went back to Plato.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it was all about, the distinction between appearance and reality.
Yeah.
So you can say, look, we're interested in exploring experience, right. And then you'd be right.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in the nature of truth, which many are,
mm-hmm.
then you are interested in
that story. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's right. I'm just saying in this context.
What would it look like for... What would it be like for it to look like the Earth is going around the sun?
I remember reading, I think it was, I can't remember who it was now, Brian Swimming or somebody, said that he had trained himself.
Yes, Brian Swimming.
Yeah, to see it that way, to experience it that
That's
way.
That's not what I mean. I mean, isn't this what it looks like for the Earth to go around the sun? Is the Earth is going around the sun.
Yeah,
so this
right.
is what going around the sun
yeah.
looks like.
Yeah, and in fact, that's why I realized this
it does
week,
look that way.
That's why I realized this week that I really haven't been using this example the right way. Because we never see the sun going through the sky, actually. It you know, we see the sun over here, we see the sun a little later. I mean, if you stared at the sun the whole time, you'd be blind, right? So you know, we see the sun in one place, we see the sun in another place, and then we have told a story, which is now our lived story, which is that the sun moves through the sky in some sense, which really tends to assume, imply then, that the Earth is stationary in relationship to the sun.
And I still don't,
but those are just propositional things.
But I still don't, never understand this example, because uh-huh. surely the reason to put the sun at the center is just because it makes the explanation simpler.
Mm-hmm.
But you could just choose a different point of reference, and then, okay, it would be more difficult to account for the movement.
That's true.
But you know, not one is more real than the other one.
Okay.
Like that.
Well, so theoretically there are issues there, but just in terms of the lived story, I'm saying no doubt the sun is moving around. The sun is moving through the sky. That's basically it. Okay.
Do you know that Husserl wrote a very celebrated book called "The Earth Doesn't Move"?
Oh no, I didn't know that.
It was exactly about that.
Exactly that point.
Because he said experience is rooted. Somewhere
mm-hmm.
here, where we are.
I see. That's interesting. This one also wants.
And I have to credit my source. My comment is directly from Wittgenstein. So that he had this conversation. He came out to the corridor. He met a friend, and he asked his friend, "Why is it that they say it was natural for the ancients to think that the sun went around the earth?"
Mm-hmm.
And his friend said, "Well, because it looks like the sun went around the earth." And then Wittgenstein said, "What would it look like if it looked like the earth went around
right.
the sun?"
Right.
And
right.
meaning, there's some puzzle here because. The lived story, I mean, this is what it looks like for the Earth to go around the sun. So there has to be
right.
something in addition to the lived, in this lived story, maybe you need a story there. It isn't just appearances, but an interpretation or a narration or something.
That's what I'm saying.
You
need a lived story. You need a lived story. I have another example, which when I thought about this one, I thought, well, wait a minute, this isn't just a perceptual thing. Well, maybe I will for a moment go into this thing about the child. We tend to think of science as wanting to answer the question why, that is, as wanting to explain things. It's very unsatisfying in terms of a lived story to try to explain things at a theoretical level.
Mm-hmm.
And the example that I have in mind here is the child asking, why is the sky blue? So I think, I don't know, one could do surveys, but it seems to me that usually parents, when they're asked that question, try to explain to the best of their knowledge what the scientific reason is for the sky being blue. It seems to me that that's not at all what the child is really asking about. I don't know how you explain it otherwise. I mean, there are probably myths in other cultures that say something about it. The child is trying to piece together a lived story. And if you give them the theoretical explanation, what you're really telling them, the lived story that you're giving them, is that the only explanations that count are theoretical explanations. That's the lived story that's getting communicated. And maybe an explanation if you've got a really smart parent who actually knows, because I know it was very puzzling for people for a long time, and you've got a child who can actually somehow grok it. Then they've got that piece of propositional knowledge. But really, the lived story is happening at a different level. It's happening at this level of
yeah,
what counts as reality?
Before I pass on, what would a answer to that question be, even in rough outline from the lived story perspective?
Oh, you'd have to have some story. I mean, as I said, there must be myths and other, because I don't know anything to say. In the first place, I don't know what it's saying. I think I used to know. I don't know what it's saying. Yeah, right. You could have a story which said,
God painted it. Right. God spilled
an ink. What distinction you have between the why? You can have why as what's the purpose of scarving the load.
Yeah.
That's a very different.
That's a different. That's another question.
How come?
Right.
Is
blue. Right.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't God painted it blue? God's favorite color is blue, and God painted it blue. Why is that not a theoretical answer?
Oh well, it has to do with then what your relationship is to God. If God is in fact somebody capable of inhabiting a lived story, then it's going to be part of a lived story rather than a theoretical answer. That's what I suggest here. But I realize these examples are all, you know, potentially problematic. And as long as we're in that mode, I thought I would talk about Santa Claus for a moment. It occurred to me not too long ago that the Santa Claus story, that's St. Nicholas, right?
It's not true.
Right. Is actually, you know, kids are told that, children are told that, and it's you know, they can accept it into their lived story, and then it really becomes kind of a traumatic thing when they're told, no, that was just a lie, right? Or that was just a story that they told you, or something along those lines. Because the original lived story actually has those wonderful moral dimensions. They're kind of simplistic, but, you know, if you're good all year, you'll be rewarded, right? It's communicating a very fundamental, basic message that people probably ought to learn, or you don't believe it, but, you know, it's kind of nice if you live in a society where people believe that.
Christian karma.
Yeah. But, you know, probably more damaging is the fact that you're presented this as the way things are, and then the people you trust tell you it's not, you know, no, that's not the way things are. That was just a fairy tale. It's kind of problematic. I don't want to dwell on that. Okay, I can skip that. I did want to just mention this as a story I heard once years ago, and a story in any technical sense, but since I was thinking about the sun rising, it was a story about an anthropologist who was visiting a tribe, mm-hmm. I think an Indian tribe, and every day in the morning before sunrise, people would go out to a certain special sacred place, and they would do special prayers to make the sun rise. So the anthropologist watched this for a while, and he said, well, what would happen if you said those prayers in the afternoon? And people looked at him as though he was completely crazy. They said, why in the world would you even conceive of saying these prayers in the afternoon? You know, it doesn't fit. It's the story makes sense, right? It's not a theoretical proposition. It's like, well, the reason I say these prayers is because that makes the sun come up. And yeah, people might say those words, but not on the basis of theory, but on the basis of that's the way things are. And you don't just mess around with that. You don't say, let's, you know, change a few variables.
And it's repeatable.
Right. Okay. So that's why I said before that first person inquiry is not about truth. Because truth really arises within the context of a story. Right? And I'll give you one more example that occurred to me. I thought people might find it interesting. And that is, it helps you make the distinction. I'm not sure this is the last example. I think it is. It helps you make the distinction. It helps you, I think, make some sense out of the Mary story, because when you say, okay, Mary has. Let's assume, I'm going to simplify it a little more. There's a more simple version than what Ron gave. Mary has all the theoretical knowledge that's available about colors, right? But she has a lived story, which has no room in it for colors. She goes out and she sees colors. Now her lived story includes colors. That's a dramatic shift. It's a radical shift. That's the lived story. The theoretical knowledge has nothing to do with it. Okay. Examples from experience. Well, okay, so we've been talking about centering, and I'm not going to take you through another centering practice, although it would be nice, because I just don't have time for this. I think you understand. That's exactly what we're aiming at with the centering practice, is to shift the lived story. So it's not a big shift, as I said a couple of days ago, it's just a foot, you know. But of course, in terms of lived story, it's you know, it's a different universe. It's a different story. It's inhabiting a different reality. And that really is the same point. Once you are centered in the heart, the whole
of your experience is different. And so that doesn't just mean that your physical relationship to the world is different, but maybe different dimensions of experience are opening up to you. Right? So when you look around the room and see people from that center, it's a different, you know, your relationship to those people is different. And I was going to give you, I was going to work with music, but I'm going to skip that. I was going to work with sight, and I'm going to suggest this to you if you'd like to do this on your own, because I don't have time to do it now. And that is, my suggestion is going to be that you go back to those places where you took your photos last night, and try to take exactly the same posture, and then spend about a minute looking at the same thing that you looked at, and try to do it from the heart, and just see what that experience is like. I do think it occurred to me, I think I say this in the next little bullet point, that, two things actually. One is, I think Roz really stacked the deck because she had us take on a mechanical role. She said, you are the camera, right? Which is sort of saying, you are not a human being. So I don't know if you people really reacted that way, but that would certainly tend to throw you into a different reality, one that didn't even have a little story if you took it seriously, right? But it's kind of puzzling to me, actually, that people did have a strong reaction to that in the sense of getting very argumentative, I guess you could say, when in fact it was a very small part of the experience. You know, I found the most interesting part of that experience being led around with my eyes closed. Somehow it was different from the night before, but, you know, at a certain point really having to trust or bond, and like, you know, I've been moving kind of like this. And then he said, you can trust me. So I started walking like this. That was very interesting. why the seeing part changed that, I don't know. That's what this... Well, let's do it again. Well, let's do it again, but not on my nickel, as somebody said. okay. Skip all that. So now I want to try to develop a structure. This is, again, Claire said this last night, help clarify for me what I'd be saying this morning. She said, well, if it's going to be scientific, you have to have a structure, right? Your method has to have a structure. I'm not sure, am I putting those two things together the right way? Your method has to have a structure?
Method is a structure.
Yeah. Okay. But structure, anyway, was the word that stuck in my mind. I thought, yeah, right, that's what I'm doing. Okay. So, what is this structure going to do? Well, you're going to change consciousness by changing the lived story. That's what I said in answer to Ron's point before, right? The lived story is the content of your consciousness, although that's a rather misleading way to say it, and I'll say more about it later. And I'm not going to worry about whether it's embodied or kinesthetic or enacted. Those are all interesting questions, I think. Okay. Now, here's the point. Everybody has a lived story, let's say. It's been the way I've been talking about it. The whole point of science, it seems to me, is to say that we want to go beyond the lived story. People are trapped in these dumb lived stories, right? They don't really know the way things are because they just have a folk psychology or a folk physics or a folk whatever. They just have this way of understanding things. It's based on a story that nobody's ever really thought to question. So we need to go beyond that. We need to have a trustworthy way of doing that. And that's what science ultimately is about, kind of at the deepest level. It's a way of refining our knowledge of certain fields. And, of course, the big issue in first person, third person is, can we bring consciousness within the scope of that particular approach? But in so one way or another, and I haven't said anything about what science's third-person science methods are for that, but I will, means going beyond what seems to be so, Michelle. Did you want to say?
No.
Okay. Okay. Here is a quote in two parts from Dennett, and I'm sure that's much too small to read. I'm sorry. This is from a debate, an online debate. Well, it wasn't online originally, I don't think, that Dennett had with Chalmers. It's available online. I think it's now been published in a book, but I was using the online version, and it's published under the title The Fantasy of a First-Person Science. So it's certainly
relevant. So it's a debate that Dennett had with Chalmers. He calls it the A team and the B team. Chalmers insists that he just knows that I leave out consciousness. How does he know? He says he just does. He has a gut intuition, something he has sometimes called direct experience. I know the intuition well. I can feel it myself. We've learned to dismiss other such intuitions in the past. The obstacles that so long prevented us from seeing the earth as revolving around the sun. Or seeing that living things were composed of non-living matter. It still seems that the sun goes around the earth, and it still seems that a living thing has some extra spark, some extra ingredient that sets it apart from all non-living stuff, but we've learned not to credit those intuitions. I think this is a very nice statement of this notion that what science is about is moving beyond the way things seem to be, which is moving beyond the lived story. How do you do that? You start from the way things are, what the way things seem to be, and you operate. You do some operation that is going to let you go beyond that or get rid of it or transcend it or whatever. You operate on it in some way. Now, before I go to the scientific version, let me just go back to Claire and Russ for a moment and say, how are they operating, as I take it, as I understand it, on the ordinary lived story? Because the ordinary lived story is pre-reflective. There I would be perfectly happy using that word. People won't think about it. They just accept it. So their method also, it seems to me, involves a way of operating on the lived story, on our ordinary experience, to bring out something, to bring out more knowledge, more understanding. So detailed specification is one element. I'm not going to give a very sophisticated analysis. Claire has two things that I glean from what she's done. Instead of focusing on the what is so, really on the way things are, but we don't have to worry about that. Instead of focusing on the what is so, to the how is it? So in other words, not what is the solution to the matrix of numbers, but how did you arrive at it? And the other is a focus on reliving, which Russ was clear last night in saying that he didn't really think he did it that way. Okay, that was Claire. I just thought I'd throw in William James because he's very, because he's very good. Right. And again, I'm not going to be very sophisticated. He says what you need to do is move from the center of experience to the fringe, to the halo, he calls it sometimes, to the vague. I think that's a nice word. You need to find a way of going into the vague, right? From nouns to verbs and to relations. So actually he's more interested in prepositions than verbs. So all of these things that we don't normally focus on, we need to shift our focus. He doesn't give any methods for doing that, which is a problem with James. I mean, he said a little bit maybe. But, and there's a nice quote from Heidegger that I just carry around in my head for many years. It says, where everyone looks, you find only darkness. And Amanda Bagg said something kind of similar, and Michelle picked up on it. I don't think I mentioned it here, but I mentioned it in the slide a little bit later. Another way you could do it, another specific operation, is to wake up the senses, which is going much more in a first-person direction. That's what Roz did. Well, these others were first-person, more or less. The centering we've been doing is meant to be an example. Meditation, and I won't say right now, I won't say anything about meditation. I've talked to a couple of you about that, but certainly that's a way to do it. I was going to do this very nice exercise, but we don't have time for it. Maybe this evening. We have a lot of things planned for this evening. So we probably won't be able to get into it, but I can't do it now. I'm sorry. Okay. How does third-person science do it? Well, I would pick out as the key operation abstraction. You could say reduction. There are some other verbs you might use. But I actually think abstraction and I don't know, I didn't look for the quotes I have. You can find quotes that say that pretty much. You know, what we do is abstract from experience. We generalize, that's another word you could do. Abstraction, generalization, reduction, it's all in that mode. But so abstract in the very literal sense, I think it's helpful to think of it as pulling out from, right? You pull out from experience the part that you can work with, and make sense out of it and generalize with. Okay. I heard somebody give an example the other day, but I know an example that Tartang Toku gives is the peas on a plate. He says, you know, nobody ever pays any attention to the fact that the peas on a plate are all different. Right? So it's like that. You abstract. You say, you know, how many peas are there? You don't care about them. They all are shaped a little differently.
When you say going beyond, that seems to be almost implying that, you know, you're getting closer to the truth or something real. It's just a different way of seeming in some sense. I think the distinction between something seeming and being real is within the phenomena.
I don't think beyond is quite the right word, but the distinction that I'm trying to get at is essentially the one that I was making before. You're taking the lived story and turning it into something that you can theorize about, something that you can.
What you're saying is certainly the grand tradition, all the way back.
It's the grand tradition. Yeah.
Not something you want to do, then?
Well,
if you want to do it, then you should do it. But for first person inquiry, no.
But even in first person inquiry, you can develop a theory which is useful to explain.
I like very much the distinction that Max made toward the beginning of the talk, so I'm just going to keep using it when these issues come up now and say that. That can be part of the grand project of first-person science to develop a theory, just as the story pretty much is a theory, right? Hopefully it's helpful. But it's not precisely doing first-person science.
Abstraction is not a negative process. It sounds as though you're saying abstraction is straining out all the reality and making something which isn't related to reality, whereas most useful theories have been grounded.
Right.
In an analysis of reality,
right.
Which everybody can agree, or a lot of the people in that particular community will agree, is reliable and trustworthy.
There's definitely a very important role for that, but it's not the first-person science part of it. And it's like, if somebody gives you, let me, in this exercise that I was going to give you, which involved time, and you're not going to get it now, but the warning that you went out and actually mentioned it last night was, please try to let go of all your beliefs, your theories about time, such as protension and retention, and you know, which is a nice theory. It's very helpful. It points you in certain directions, but we would really like to have you go directly to the lived story right now, and does that change in some interesting way, in which case perhaps consciousness changes. That's really all I'm saying. Merleau-Ponty, in the beginning of an essay called I Am Mind, says, science manipulates things and gives up living in them, which makes somewhat the same point, although I think that's, you know, it's a little harsh to say that it only manipulates things, but it abstracts. That's what I would say, it abstracts. Okay, so now the question is, what's the corresponding method for first-person science? And I'm going to cite just one of the, you know, Husserl, of course, has a lot to say about this. Descartes and her colleagues in this book they wrote, which I brought with me, this on Becoming Aware, present essentially a phenomenological method. You suspend, you could say bracket, you suspend your unconditional acceptance of the lived story. That's how I would say it, right? You redirect your attention to conscious experience, and then you let go. And actually, I'm going to use that same concept of letting go, but I want to try to develop it a little more. And the first two are really the preparation. Then you let go, and see what comes. See what, you know, and then they take it in directions that are a little different from what I would do, but I at least thought I should mention them. This is where I mention Amanda Bagg's and what Michelle said about it, to make the ordinary non-ordinary. That's another way of saying it, although that doesn't give you much structure. How do you do that? But that's the idea.
It's more to make the unfamiliar familiar rather than the ordinary.
Well, it's interesting to make the familiar unfamiliar, and then to make the unfamiliar available. Or some, I wouldn't say familiar. But, you know, you don't want to slot it into the same categories that you had before. But let's not go there. Okay, so I'm going to propose a very simple little model. And actually, the first part of it, I'm not so sure about. I just felt I needed the first part. So here's my model. Bring it up and let it go. Bring it up and let it go. That's what you do with experience to investigate it. You bring it up and you let it go.
Or you let it come up.
No, you actually, especially in the way I do things, mm-hmm. is you are actually doing particular exercises. For instance, center your experience in your heart. That's bringing up a certain part of your experience. That's essentially what I mean. You could say, let it come up.
Okay.
You know, I mean, and in fact, yeah, you know, it's not exactly a forceful operation. I use these words for a specific reason. I don't know how important this is, but I'm kind of fond of it, so I'm going to say it. We need to have a multidimensional operator. And what I mean by that is that abstraction, by definition, well, not maybe by definition, but it's essentially a one-dimensional thing. You're trying to turn multidimensional experience into something one-dimensional that you can work with. People might not agree completely, but I think you get the idea of where I'm, what I'm trying to say with that. But in fact, the experience itself is much more multidimensional. And so if you're going to have a methodology for first-person science, I think it needs to be multidimensional, and therefore, I think that it's helpful if the terms are multidimensional. I'm going to skip that second point and just say a word that I actually love for this, but can't, don't feel I can use, is Althaic, the Hegelian term that Hegel uses with reference to the dialectic. I love it because it is precisely multidimensional. The word Aufheben in German has these three different levels. Aufheben means literally to lift up, but kind of, I don't know if literal makes sense for it. So at one level it means to erase, so you lift off in that sense. At another level, or not another level, it's just another meaning of the word, the most common, is to preserve something. So you erase it, and at the same time you preserve it, and you lift it to a higher level. Mm-hmm. All those meanings are there in Althaven. And that's very, very close to what I have in mind. If I spoke German, I mean, if that's my native language, then I'd use Althaven. I'd just say apologies to Hegel. But I don't, and so in English I would have to use, there's two possibilities. One would be to use the usual English translation, which is sublate, which does mean more or less the same thing, but it's only sublate. Sublate. That's how they translate Althaven. S-U-B-L-A-T-E. And that's the point. It means nothing. So it's a dumb word to use. It wouldn't work.
It means to assimilate into something larger.
Yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't have a meaning, but I'm saying that it doesn't carry... You know, the words you use, if you're going to work with lived stories and direct experience, your words ought to carry with them some of the weight of your lived experience. And sublate carries no lived experience at all. It's a completely theoretical term as it's used in English.
Althaven is sometimes translated as transcend and include.
That's interesting, although I'd probably stay away from transcend just because it's too many words, too many terms. Another possibility would simply be to use lift up, because it kind of conveys the same thing, but then you'd wind up talking about uplifting, and I think that would be misleading also in somewhat the same sense as transcends. So anyway, I felt I couldn't use that. So I eventually, this bring it up is newer, as I say. To bring up, it seems to me, has these different dimensions in it. One is that you're calling attention to something. You know, let me bring this up. That's what the English means. And the other more literally means that you're lifting it up into the light, you could say. I was thinking of Russ's cone that he talked about several times last night. You go down deep here and you bring something up. So that's the bringing up. And then the letting go. As I see it, letting go is a nice word. It's not perfect, but, you know, nice, because it has these roughly three different meanings, each of which is fulfilled, brought to completion by a different preposition. You can let something go on, you can let something go free, and you can let something go away. So this is roughly like erasing, and this is something like preserving, and this is something like
liberating, non-grasping.
But in terms of the original outpatient. So I kind of like let it go. It doesn't matter too much, but it would be nice if I felt I had good words for this. This is the exercise we were going to do. Ta-da. Okay. I think, yeah, but is it science? And so I got
only... I just say yes.
Are you convinced now? Or can I stop? No. is it science?
But what do you mean by is?
It all depends on what the meaning of is, right?
Could you tell us what is?
Is the question needed?
Need it be science? Maybe not, but let me tell you why I think it does have to be. Okay. So first of all, as I said before, and I was quoting Dennett at the very beginning, if so, it's a very different kind of science, right? So then there is a natural tendency, and if there are people in this room who say it, just imagine what the rest of the world might say, to say, oh, that means science, you know, don't make a fool of yourself. Don't call this stuff science. It doesn't generate data. It doesn't generate replicable results. But those are third-person tests, right? If you say that's the test, then yes, it fails the test. But you beg the question. Those are important issues. I'm not saying they're not, and I'm not saying that, you know, I can just say, oh, well, that's just third-person. We have to have some way, something that justifies calling it science. Right? So I do say yes. And then the question is, why bother, as Steve said? That's the first question, right? So I would say for political reasons, for strategic reasons. Right? It doesn't count if it's not science.
For funding reasons.
Yeah, right. Well, funding is a long ways off. For, I mean, we hope not.
Rationale for funding in the next day.
Okay. So yes, for political and strategic reasons, for funding, for the funders, but also in terms of the culture at large, you know? It's like, you know, Ron is the guy who gets interviewed by the Observer, not... But I mean, you know, he's working on third-person science stuff. You know what I mean, okay? So science counts, science is real, you can trust science, you can believe in science. That's our lived story. Well, that's part of our lived story.
Not in the Midwest.
Well, I actually, that little part I skipped about evolution was meant to be a cautionary tale in how theory can become part of the lived story. It's interesting, but it's not really relevant here. Okay, that's kind of the short-sighted answer for political or strategic reasons. A little bit more, more long-sighted is that we're... I guess every generation or everybody always thinks of themselves as being at a critical point, but I think we're at a critical point because science takes over more and more of the world. And if it takes over consciousness, not only third-person science, I think we've got a problem. You know, we can kind of pull out the reasons for that. I think that's kind of a nice way of putting the question. Are we ready to let third-person science tell us what it means to be human? Because that's the direction we're headed in. And I have a quote here from one of Partain Chokri's books. So I bring that up. It's from Love of Knowledge. The technological model, which is his word for third-person science, I'd say. It's more complicated, but roughly. The technological model affirms the existence of two separate realms, the objective world of results and the subjective world of personal conviction and concern. Knowledge is understood to apply only in the objective realm. In the subjective realm of desires and feelings, knowledge has no role to play. Since issues of value and meaning fit into the subjective realm, they recede from view as possible subjects of knowledge or topics of public discourse. In such circumstances, what is meaningless comes to the fore by default.
Nice. Can you briefly, say in what way you think he means the technological model affirms both objectivity and subjectivity?
What he means by technological knowledge, which is what he usually calls it, is roughly knowledge that wants to make things available for use. It's got kind of a Heideggerian flavor to it. And so that means that there's someone who wants to use them, and then there's the world to be used. So it affirms that sense of the subject-object structure.
The wanting component.
Yeah. Desire is absolutely essential in this model.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I'll give you one of my favorite lines from this same book, which is not relevant unless we had done the exercise, which we didn't do, but I just love the line, so I'm going to give it to you. He says, the force of the self's desire unfolds as the momentum of linear time. So that's the time connection. Anyway. I just love that quote.
This is really sort of about, you know, the fact value thing that I was talking about last year.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful quote. I love it.
Yeah.
Business.
Okay. So that those are, you know, so there's a practical, pragmatic, strategic, tactical reason, and there's this danger, this risk that we run of really losing something vital about our humanity, and then of course we won't even notice after it's gone. And also, based on what I've been saying up until now, because of what science is.
And that, by the way, is the moral dimension right there, what you just said, about losing that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That is the moral dimension, that's right. So, and what I mean by science at its root, it goes back to what I was saying before. You know, so what science wants to do is take the knowledge that permeates, you could say, the lived story and hold it up to the light of inquiry in its own way and refine it and improve it and better it. And that is essentially what first-person science wants to do also. And yes, there are a lot of techniques for getting deeper into your experience, but for me, that motivation, that intention, is really central to what science is about and is why it's worth trying to find a first-person parallel to that third-person approach. A first-person science of consciousness is going to aim to increase knowledge. Right? So having dissed Plato, I have to remind you of know thyself and Socrates. I don't see any way for third-person science or analytic philosophy, that seems to me, to really be able to do that, to really be able to contribute much to that. I think they both leave the cave, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. The cave of the self, if you want to, if that model works for you. So it's, you know, it's a contribution to this overarching impulse to increase the knowledge, the useful knowledge, or even just the knowledge that's available to human beings.
I think you're being a bit cynical by giving in to the science-centric aspects of the culture and say, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to take that as given and then I'm going to call myself a scientist because I want a piece of that pie. Why don't you stick to your guns and say, this isn't science, but science isn't the only thing worth doing, and we should be funding, we believe in funding mathematics, mathematics isn't science, we believe in funding philosophy, philosophy isn't science. Why not believe in funding first-person inquiry? And then don't try to shoehorn it into being what it's not, which is you'll miss the people. They'll just throw you out at the very beginning if you're not extremely clear and forthcoming about how you're not science. So if you say, this is science, but, and then you list all those things, you know, that it's not reproducible, it's not, then they'll just say, well, you're wrong, and they won't listen to you anymore. But if you say, look, I know that this isn't science, but there are lots of things worth doing that aren't science. Arts are worth doing. Religion is worth doing. Philosophy is worth doing. Mathematics is worth doing. None of those are science. So it seems like you're setting yourself up for failure by insisting on this word.
It's interesting, and you may be right. I mean, I've certainly thought about it quite a bit. And I think you put that point well, and I can only think about it.
So okay, that's all I
ask. There is a dialectic. There is a dialect. You can't escape this kind of dance with science.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be there. You know, it's not. So what Ron said is very true. It's not sufficient. There is a kind of dance with science.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but we are.
You
know, but and
won't
what,
get
money
from dancing with science.
What we were talking about, Russ,
you know,
science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we can't, you know, to say, oh, we don't want to do science, means that Russ is outside, and Russ is definitely not outside.
Right. Well, don't our
and that's not Russ, don't just mean
my brush.
I mean, lots of people.
Yeah. There are differences in the approach. I think there are some first-person approaches that aim to be scientific in the narrow sense of science, and there are some approaches that don't aim to be scientific in the narrow sense of science.
Well, let me. Well, this is important, but I am really worried about. So I don't want to eat into Prabhupada's time anymore. Okay, two, and then I'll go on.
Okay, I was just going to elaborate on Ron's point, but a more fundamental question you can ask is, have I got anything to offer that is demonstrably of any use?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you have something that is demonstrably of yours,
mm-hmm.
then there are specific funding bodies that would be interested. I can think of, well, you know them, Templeton, FESA, aid
yeah,
bodies,
right.
You know, the Art Council, is there a social value?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are people's lives demonstrably enhanced
mm-hmm.
by it?
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
the way to go with this project. That it, as you say, it's not all hard science.
Right, that kind of turns it into social science then, but maybe that's okay.
Social science is funded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Claire, Claire, and then I'll go on, because I do want to say one more thing about what seems to me to be scientific about this.
I ask my question afterwards.
Okay.
Can I just say two sentences?
Two.
You know, many scientists, for example, Richard Feynman, see their science as giving them the basis for wonder.
Yeah.
Of a sort, which is not that, you know, their scientific knowledge gives them a sense of the world that is wonderful,
mm-hmm.
which, is enhancing and does do some of the things that you're talking about.
I think that goes to
a discussion that Max mm-hmm. and I had the other day, and when Max was actually putting forward
mm-hmm.
as a basis for, you know, not a defense of science, but why he thought the hard problem had to be tackled and mm-hmm. it couldn't just be kind of glanced off and dissolved.
Okay, well, let me say that I think that is actually related to the next slide. It's related to what Ron said. I want to go to the issue of objectivity. It's not purely what's mentioned on the next slide, but the way that I put it together is what Ron said, is that that's exactly what happens for the scientist whose lived story has to do with the vocation of being a scientist. And I think that's fine. I think that's great. So again, the connection is as I would say, it is at this very deep level where you say you've got the lived story, you want to be able to go beyond it or above it or however you want to say that. That's what first-person science wants to do. That's what third-person science wants to do. It's because I feel comfortable at that level that I feel comfortable calling it science. But I do understand what you're saying, and I'm not sure about the answer to this. This goes to the issue of objectivity in Ron's image of the acrobat and the butterfly. A flexibility to be anywhere. If the scientist can be objective in Ron's sense, that kind of, you know, the view from anywhere. I think that is exactly the same sense of objectivity that a first-person science would look at. And it's really a way of restating this other point. You don't take a position that limits you. You know, the lived story is a limiting position. It's real. If you can get in touch with it, you'll feel like a more fulfilled human being. But you will not be advancing the cause of knowledge, let's put it that way. I had to put real. I had to put real in quotes, I suppose. Okay. I think that's basically what I wanted to say about that point on objectivity. And can there be a dialogue? Well, there would have to be willing mutual respect, but you know, it doesn't tell you how you get there. I think the notion of mutually generative restraints might be helpful at some point. I think there are prospects, and this is really what Max was talking about, for showing that it's useful: therapy, medicine, social science. And I say, you know, in the end, I leave that to others, because I just don't have the background or the basis of where would you make those connections? And maybe the answer is, you know, you don't do it now because you don't make the claim that what you're doing is scientific. I'm really not sure. That's the issue. There's one more point to make. Can a first-person science meet the test of intersubjectivity? I just thought of this quote this morning while I was preparing this. I actually left out part of it. Doesn't matter. The first part of it says something like, though the wise man lives among fools, he is not stained, just as the lotus emerges unstained from the water. Though sages live far apart, like the water lily and the moon, they admire each other at a distance. I think I sort of screwed up this slide somehow. Beth, okay, why do I have that image of the Buddha in there?
It has to do with what a possible test for intersubjectivity would be. Because if you say there has to be an intersubjectivity, I think it makes sense to say, if you are doing an inquiry yourself and you're coming to all sorts of understanding, that is not yet the basis for the science, because it's just a personal private experience, kind of buys into that same distinction between the objective and intersubjective on the one hand, and the private and subjective on the other, and there's nothing to say, nothing to talk about. So how could there be intersubjectivity? This is a card that someone sent me years ago, and I happen to have it in my cabin over there, so I took a photo of it. I really like this a lot, and the reason I do is because it really conveys something about the quality of the Buddha. That's the Buddha. I think it's very evocative. And my point is really, and actually Ron said something that also touches on this. He said something like, you don't necessarily have to tell people, you can show people instead. And he took art as his example. It seems to me that if we are in the business of first-person inquiry, and if in fact that is changing and deepening or expanding our understanding of what consciousness is, then that should show up in who we are, because after all, we are conscious beings. That is what is defining us, who we are. So it should show up. And if it shows up, then it should be something that others can recognize. And I'm not really saying, there's one way to say that, to think of that, which would be to say, well, you could see something in, you could see something in other people, this kind of special quality, which is suggested in an image like this. But that's a pretty high standard to meet. I would say probably a better standard is you can see that people are engaged in this kind of inquiry. Mm. And that's already a lot. And when you see that, I think you recognize people who are on the same path, and that's what you would say in a spiritual tradition, who are part of the same community of inquiry. I think that's a more kind of acceptable Western way of saying it. And I think if you develop that community of inquiry, then ultimately that's going to be the basis of your science, whether in the end you call it a science or not. Okay. Thank you. So, we don't really have time to do too much. We do have, you know, a little bit of time. We go to one. Okay. So we'll take about 5 minutes for questions. We'll take a short break, and then Irvine will give his paper. We probably won't get out of here till 1, but that's okay.
Correct. For me, there are a lot of things to discuss, because you seem to have really a different idea of for example, mine.
Uh-huh.
It's very different. It looks very different.
Mm-hmm. We'll probably figure out a way to agree, don't you? But anyhow.
I would like to ask you first. From where come this two-step process? Bring it up and let it go. Mm-hmm. From where does it come?
Do you want me to cite authority, or do you want me to say it's based on my experience? I think it's basically I'll tell you where it comes from. It really comes out of the kinds of exercises that I'm used to doing. And this example of centering in the heart, which unfortunately is the only one we have to do, will have to stand as an exemplar. Bring it up, I basically mean that there are parts of our experience that we are not used to looking at, or not used to questioning, things that we take for granted. And so bringing it up is meant to point toward that kind of singling out, or bringing before the footlights of consciousness, or making available for inquiry. Right? That's what the bringing up is meant to do. And the letting go is my take on the process that happens, where you don't try to transform or discard what your experience is,
you try to change it in the way that I suggested you study it. So it's based on my experience.
Yes, but in fact, so it comes from your experience.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, this double step process mm-hmm. is, in fact, a generic structure, an abstract generic structure
mm-hmm.
Of the process of becoming aware or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an abstract generic structure.
Mm-hmm.
If it has any value, it comes from the comparison of a lot of experiences.
Yeah.
And if it can have any intersubjective value,
mm-hmm.
it has to come from to be a lot of descriptions of many experiences of different persons.
Well,
the same generic close to the generic structure of the Varela de programmation, and
right.
One of those. The techniques were the basis of this the Pradernage structure is
mm-hmm.
the explicitation in
tangible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I
wanted to say is that you use abstraction. You are using abstraction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You are using, and you show it is an example of the possibility of reproducible result of
if you do this,
it's difficult for me to explain, but
mm-hmm.
you are showing
mm-hmm.
Exactly to the contrary that you said that you were explaining before, that first person science doesn't need abstraction. And the first person science of consciousness doesn't depend on reportable knowledge, etc., etc. I think.
Okay, I think
it's difficult for me to explain.
No,
I would like to talk again with you or anybody
mm-hmm.
about that. But for me, it's a very necessary, crucial thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think I understand what you're saying. I don't. I think I said or meant to say that I don't know, you used the word need. I early on, as I said, I latched on to Max's distinction that it's part of the grand project of doing first-person inquiry. And I think it actually is a pretty essential part, because if you don't have the structures, if you don't have some kind of theoretical structure, then you don't have any way of calling the lived story into question. Now, what I would try to do is take the theoretical structure and shape that toward a lived story, first toward a told story, and then the lived story, and try to bring that into the lived story. And that is really what an exercise would try to do. But I'm agreeing with you that it's very helpful to, and maybe essential, maybe necessary, to have a theoretical structure or way of looking at things, which is a non-standard way of looking at things. Now I think maybe that may only be necessary on the level of method. I think I probably would say that it's not at all necessary in terms of having a theoretical view or explanation of the way things are. But if you put it in terms of what to do,
mm-hmm.
then yes, I think the danger is always that you're going to get just stuck in pre-reflective experience. You're never going to break out of that. And so you need to have a way to get out of it. And one of the best tools we have available is theory and abstraction. So yes, I agree. It's just a question of, do you stay? Is that what you're aiming at? Is that the goal, which I think essentially is the case in third-person science? You work with your abstractions, you manipulate them, as Merleau-Ponty said, or do you try to really stay in contact with the things themselves? And I realize that there's a very honorable tradition that tries to do that, tries to stay in touch with the things themselves. I just kind of stayed away from it because I and I'm talking about phenomenology now in just a broad sense, because there's some things about it that I don't work for me. Some of the approaches and some of the goals they have I can't quite understand them. Maybe if I understood them more, I mean, maybe I value them more. But it seems to me that very often they really are still, they're trying to arrive at a truth, at an essential truth, at the level of the way things are. And that, I think, is the wrong move. So that really is why I don't go along with the phenomenological. But the methods are really, you know, more power to them.
Jack, one of the things that I was privileged to do before I came here was to do a workshop on the Bardo at the Lingma Institute.
Right.
And I found it very interesting, and there was a very detailed story that they were telling, which you all know about, because it's in your tradition, about how things are.
Right.
Not just in life, but in death.
Right.
And it's deeply ingrained in Buddhist philosophy.
Right.
Same applies in Hindu philosophy. So if you go to, say, the work of Aurobindo, who is highly respected and also influential in the West,
right,
has a very detailed story about it, what he thinks is going on.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that you know, for instance, in the great project of preserving the teachings, you know, which you're very much engaged in, part of the reason for that is because there's the deep feeling that there is knowledge here, which has been gained by a particular procedure, and which needs to be preserved and passed on, and so on, which has, you know, enormous import, perhaps, for us all.
Yes.
So my kind of instinct is that there is, you know, insofar as any of this is true, there is a kind of communal investigation with intersubjectivity and structure and methods and all that stuff. And so my question is, in what way does creative inquiry, as you understand it, fit into this grand scheme?
Right. Well, you know, I don't mean sound dismissive, although perhaps I do, of lived stories. I would say that that's a lived story. And it has its truth value. And in the case of the Dharma tradition, I would say it has a remarkable truth value. And part of the value that it has is that in the end, it does lead you to question all stories. You know, the Buddha said, he said, my teachings are like a raft. If you come to a river and you need to cross the river, then you build yourself a raft and you cross the river. But if when you get to the other side, you say to yourself, this raft has been so useful to me that it might really continue to be helpful at some other time, and you pick it up and strap it to your back and walk on through the forest with the raft on your back, then you will just get in your own way.
I just want to ask you, the way you presented things, you say consciousness studies will, and you know, first person inquiry is, you seem to be conflating your methodology, which has deep roots in Buddhism, which I think would be usefully acknowledged. You seem to be conflating creative inquiry with the whole of consciousness studies, whereas we have in the room everybody involved in consciousness studies. And I think all the way through your talk, for me, you've set up grand claims and then contradicted them almost immediately within your own presentation. Because you've acknowledged the validity of Claire's approach, which is actually listening to other people's reports of their own experience, and yet you're saying creative inquiry is your own deepening understanding of the structure of consciousness. So you said two things in your presentation, which we all do, of course, but the conflict in you was very obvious, and then you say
you know, theory is simply abstraction. But as Claire said, you've been doing that all the way through your talk. You said you conflated creative inquiry, first person inquiry, and consciousness studies as if they're all one thing. And I think for me, to make your position stronger, I would say creative inquiry is part of consciousness studies, that what you're doing is working towards a theory of consciousness based on practice, on the practice of consciousness, yourself and all of us as individuals. It's replicable in the sense that we all, through different ways, can experience the structures of consciousness which Buddhism has developed a very strong theory, a theoretical basis for.
Right.
And I wouldn't turn my back on theory and dismiss it as abstraction. I'd say use theory to help guide, explain, and understand and be part of the story. So I don't want to say, I mean, there's a lot more to be said, so I'm going to be around the room at once.
Well, that's already a lot, and I don't know that I can respond to all of it, but let me try to respond to what kind of stays with me. You're right that I shouldn't conflate what I'm doing with either first-person studies or consciousness studies, and I'm sure that I did make it sound like that in the course of my presentation. So I apologize for having done that. I really was just focusing on what I do and my understanding of what you know, how first-person consciousness studies or how first-person studies should be developing. What I said about Claire's method and why I thought it was useful in the context of what I was presenting was that I said I thought that I wasn't so interested in the gathering of data, although you know, I realize Claire is saying something like that, but I wasn't so interested in the gathering of data, but it did seem to me to be a very useful way to go deeper into your own experience as the one who is having the experience, because the interview method either can help you see something that you could then apply, you know, about your past experience that you could then apply later, or in the process of being interviewed, you might well have a deepening understanding of what is involved in your unconscious experience. So I think that that is. I don't think it's a contradiction, is really what I'm saying. I think there's, you know, I recognize the role for something like that, and I think it's not quite central, but I do recognize the role. I don't think I'm working towards a theory. I really don't. I think that I agree, and I think Claire's question helped clarify that, and clarifies for me too. But I did say at various times that I was presenting a theory when I presented that whole story business, right? So I was presenting. You know, there's a nice term in the Buddhist tradition. Although I'll say something about that in a moment. There's a nice term in the Buddhist tradition that gets translated as fruitful fiction, and I think that's a nice way to think about theories. Theories are fruitful fictions, okay? And so I think there is a role for theory. But I don't think that's going to be what you're aiming at. I think what you're aiming at is more on the level of experience. And with respect to Buddhism, I certainly am not turning my back on Buddhism, but I don't want to present this. It's not because I'm covering it over. It's because, for a variety of reasons. But I think that if I had to really feel confident that what I was presenting was consistent with Buddhist teachings, that's a lifetime of study. I'm not making that claim. I don't know of anything that's inconsistent, but it's just more than I'm prepared to get into. So I see it as independent of theory. I'm surprisingly covered most of what you said, but that's helpful. I can see that I'm going to be listening to this tape. It's recording several times because there's been a lot of really good points. Seeing no hands, maybe that is a time to take a break so that we have a little time left. So we'll take a 10-minute break. We'll try and limit it to 10 minutes, okay? Mm-hmm.
Okay.